This is Hacker Public Radio episode 2989 for Thursday, the 16th of January 2020. Today's show is entitled Hacker Public Radio 2019-20 New Year Show Episode 1. It is hosted by Kevin Wisher and is about 141 minutes long and carries an explicit flag. The summary is 8th Annual New Year Show, Sin Brings Toys.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by Archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm awake.
Good, good, good. Looks like Mumble's recording. I'm recording it here. That's what the ZHPR stream in LL. And the Z stream is Kevin's one, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Just do some social media stuff now.
So which social media outlets did you post to?
Facebook, Mastodon, Twitter.
I did a Twitter and Mastodon last night.
Okay, cool. Didn't see yours coming through. What's your Mastodon handle? Let me follow you if I don't already.
Surprise, I thought you already did. I think it's HonkyCuckoo01. Hold on.
9 minutes? Yeah, 1 day, 2 hours still.
I know I'm following you. I just saw your post. I'm just trying to figure out which version of mess that I'm on. It's just Honky Magoo, not Honky Magoo. Oh, there you go. At Honky Magoo at Mastodon.cloud.
One moment. 1 second. No, I'm following you, all right. How come I haven't seen that post?
I don't know. I wouldn't screw anything up trying to post it.
Anywho, I think you did. Ah, there it is. It's in my timeline. Didn't scroll down far enough. Doom. Okay, excellent. So it's on. Does HPR have a its own Facebook page? That is the question. Let me just do some logging out and logging in here. Okay, 5 minutes. Okay, what are we forgetting?
I'm not sure. Do you feel like we're forgetting something, or is it...
No, just general forgettingness. Are we forgetting anything? So we've done this 8 times. You think we know better?
I don't know. I feel good. I'm down here on
what
time.
What I'm going to do is I'll put a QR code thing for the live stream on. Don't know. Will that help? Will that help?
I don't know.
How would that help?
I don't know. A QR code? Did you just
what
have
what
it?
What would be the point in doing that?
The fun of generating a QR code for something?
Yes.
That's part of the reason why we do some stuff, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, you're right, sir. I need no other reason than that. Yep. 2 minutes. Right, it is done.
What's on the QR code?
What's on the HBO web? I click on it, and let's see what happens. Okay, now I will count the number of seconds until I hear myself counting the number of seconds on the live stream. One. Oh, no, we won't, because in 7 seconds, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. 2, 1. Hi, everybody. My name is Ken Fallon, and joining me today is
Honky Magoo.
And we're here to welcome you to the 8th annual New Year Show. What is the New Year Show, Honky?
It's basically just one very, very long recording that anyone can hop on and say Happy New Year and sit around and talk.
And we're now desperately checking to make sure the stream is working. Seems to be. And for no reason at all, I have a QR code up on the website, but okay, fine. It seems to be working. But my recording of the mixdown doesn't seem to be working.
Well, that's not good. Yeah, this was started, 8 years ago by Pokey?
Yeah, I reckon.
And I believe it was originally 12.
Sorry, you dropped out there. We may never know what was said.
Going, and I believe Kevin is doing a stream recording.
Right, let's see if this helps. Nope. So, testing, testing, 1, 2, 3.
Hello.
No, it doesn't seem to be writing to disk for some reason. Try it again. I unmounted it and remounted it. Nothing! Why is it doing this to me? Tony H. Could that be Tony Hughes?
Tony, your lips are moving, but we can't hear you. We still can't hear you, dude. Can you hear us?
So Tony's joined us. Can't hear him. My recording status doesn't seem to be working on offline Samba share, even though it was working earlier on. fantastic. This is exactly how the New Year
right.
show is supposed to go.
The only thing I can say is at least I woke up and I was here on time this year.
Yeah, excellent. There's no recording of it, at least in my set. I'm going to try the old turning it off and on again trick. See if that. Oh, do you know what? I wonder would that have helped? Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3. No, it didn't. No, I'm just going to boot this box again, see what happens. The issue with the recordings is they get quite large, so you need external discs. So I thought I'd mount it to a SIF share that we use for like YouTube videos and stuff like that. But that's not working out.
True. See, that's why it's usually good to record the stream. And that's also why I just set up TeamViewer on this. So, because if it's like, if also if after like a certain amount of time, if the recording seems to degrade, excuse me. So
it doesn't like it at all.
Yeah, I team viewer on this, so about I might just set an alarm for like every 3 hours or so. I'm gonna stop recording and start recording, but I can do it from wherever. We still can't hear you.
I'm connected again. Testing, testing. Van 203 says recording started, and there is a mumble recording over there. So that's fantastic.
We'll see you then, Tony. I might be on around noon. I don't remember. All depending on what the day gives.
I'm here working in the back room anyway, as I do. Ah, it didn't mount. Interesting. So I'm now going to switch these so it auto-mounts all this stuff. We'll see how far that goes. By putting no auto, getting rid of no auto at the beginning of the line in the FS tab file. Attempting to sprinkle some technical content into the New Year show there.
We're bound to have a little.
No, we're bound to have discussions about guns sooner or later.
And food.
Yep. Yeah, probably no harm to mention at this point that the views expressed on the New Year show, all 26 hours of it, do not necessarily represent the views of the HPR community or any of us putting on this show. Just for your information, their views are those of the people themselves. And may be regretted, depending on the amount of alcohol they have or have not in their bodies at any given time. That may not be obvious to everybody that that is the case, but that is kind of the whole point of this HBR New Year show, is just come in, chill out.
Hey, yo, have a good time.
Okay, you're heading?
No, I'm just reiterating what you said.
Yep, good.
You know, everybody's still asleep here, I can hang out for a while.
What time is this? That's the other thing we do in the New Year show. What time is it there?
5 o'clock, 5:10 now.
Do you have work on today?
No. I took off. I worked Christmas Eve, and then I'm off until the 2nd.
Cool, that's a nice break.
It's a nice time to have off. Nice time to spend it with the family.
Let's try this again. Testing, testing. 1, 2, 3. My kids have found the live show on HPR and are now listening on their mobile phones and laughing. Come over here and laugh into the thing so everybody can hear you laughing. She can't even move now. She's laughing so fast. Breathe in. So funny. Okay, that stream seems to be recording again. Yes, I'm back to the topic of annoying teenagers. Anyway, timeanddate.com. That should also be on the website because it's quite useful. And she's just sent the link to the entire family WhatsApp group. Great. That's handy. Sinead, because I'm working here in the back room, so I can go, Sinead, come get me a hammer, please. Have you eaten your breakfast?
Oh, there we go. What you doing?
Chapman Islands have just had their new year.
Yep.
Hello, go ahead over. What did you say?
I said, don't they know that their dad sits in the back room and podcasts and whatnot?
Usually they're watching TV or something while I'm doing that.
Ah, my wife just calls it. I'm going down to the basement to be a geek.
Oh, yeah, very nice. There it is. I'll put a link into the days and time thing.
Did you get anything cool for Christmas?
Nope. We have the, we're in that period where we had Santa Claus here on the 5th of December. And then that kind of, our kids are getting a little bit old for that now. So we don't really do the Christmas present thing.
What was on the 5th of December?
It's Santa Claus, St. Nicholas. He comes in a steamboat from Spain, etc.
That's cool. I'm not sure I've heard of that.
Yeah, there's Santa Claus, Father Christmas isn't universal. The Saint, St. Nicholas, whatever, does comes over in various different forms around the Christmas period. So from December right into January, kids are getting presents in different parts of the world. There's a good YouTube video. Hold on, I'll find it and put it into the show notes because we should be keeping track of the show notes. Shivna, that's the guy, Shivna. He's done a Christmas video.
So basically just at some point in December, people get gifts and that's it?
Pretty much, yep.
So you guys really don't have like that whole Christmas season type of a thing?
Where did it go? Yeah, we do. We have the, okay. Santa Claus. What happens is there's a news report that Santa Claus is leaving Spain. Yeah. And he has a boat and he's got all these helpers on it. And that's a controversial now because they're all in blackface. But originally it was Santa Claus was a taken from the story of Saint Nicholas, who was a Turkish saint, a saint from around Turkey, and he had a helper who was from a Moor from wherever. So that's where the blackface comes from. So in where that culture has gone to the US, they still do Santa Claus and Swarte Piet with a bishop dressed as a bishop, and then somebody from the African American community comes and acts as the helper. But that was going on here. So this is where the controversy is. So they had years to fix this because it was being commented on for years here, and they tried to get away from the blackface, and basically there was people who didn't want that, and because it's a tradition, and so that's a whole thing. But anyway, if we can leave that aside for a minute, then he comes on a boat with all these helpers, and then he goes to his house for about 4 weeks, and you leave out your shoe at the chimney, and then you write your letter into, and you put it in the shoe. And then for us, it was every Saturday, you sing songs down the chimney, and then the Santa Claus hears these songs, and then we'll deliver you, we'll take your letter, and we'll leave you some small gift, like a bag of chocolate coins or some marzipan figurines and stuff like that. And although some other kids, depending on the situation, they might get larger presents and stuff. And then on or around the 5th of December, some people do it on the 5th of December always, which it's not a national holiday, so you don't get the day off. They do it in the evening. We tended to do it on Saturday afternoon. The Piet would arrive in your house and knock on the door or in the attic or something. And then you would search the house and you'd find a paper note, pepper, like, what's Dutch word, English word for paper note? Pepper nuts, biscuity type things that are associated with this time of the year. And then you would find bags full of presents, you bring them down, you'd open them, and you sing thank you to Santa Claus up the chimney, and then away you go. That's the summary of that. Surprisingly, I know it sounds complicated, but it is actually surprisingly well done because it's all coordinated with the children's TV. The main national TV station has it like live broadcasts and comment and stuff like that, and they have stories, and they have each of the individual Pete are like, there's a one Pete looks after a horse, and then there's another one that is managing the household and stuff like that.
How long have they been doing this?
As long as Santa.
But after,
so I put a link there in the show notes to the video.
After the 5th, it's all done?
Yeah, pretty much. And then you have, then it switches to kind of Christmas. Like, instantaneously switches to Christmas. And, yeah, people don't tend to give. It's more for gift-giving between adults, but it's not like the €600 €1,000 that you get in Ireland or places like that. It's like, well, for us, it's not. It's definitely nothing. We tend to get books for the kids, or this year we got like family puzzles, jigsaw puzzle. Just have something under the tree. Wow. I'm going through my Facebook post, and 4 people have flagged, mark myself safe during. That is scary. Of course, I only go through my Facebook once a year.
Marked you as safe. I don't know Facebook. What does that mean, mark you as safe?
Somebody marked herself as safe during the Gilroy Garlic Festival shooting.
Oh, gotcha.
Okay, I'm all caught up. 1 year's worth of Facebook in 5 minutes. We're done. Log out until next year.
I'm on Facebook, but the only thing people I follow are family members. So,
yeah.
Kind of go on maybe like once a month, just kind of scroll through just to get caught up with the family, and then go, yep. All right. Then again, I think about the only social media platform that I really keep up with, it would be probably MeWe. And that's usually just because any type of stuff I find for the Lugcast, articles I find for the Lugcast, I kind of throw in there.
We should probably mention this is called the HPR New Year Show, but it actually should be the Linux Lugcast New Year Show, given the amount of work you guys doing it, because I'm not doing anything for it.
Well, Kevin gave up on the Lugcast. He didn't want to participate anymore. So it's pretty much just me who's representing the Lugcast here.
Okay. It's good. I do constantly follow the Lugcast. So I always fear now, since Tattoo made the comment about, you know, people pod fading and not knowing the people were listening to them, I religiously listen to the Lugcast.
Thank you.
We're going to miss 50 this year. To be honest, he will be on by now.
Yep. And he probably would have been most of the gun conversation, too.
Yeah, and the beer conversation, truth be told. Yeah, I had promised to go out and, you know, shoot off some firearms on his farm. And firearms safely away, have a few beers, and discuss guns with him. But alas, that will not pass.
Yeah, 2019 has not been a fantastic year.
No, it's been a bad year for me mentally. A lot of mental health issues. Sounds like you. No, just down and depressed by times.
I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, it catches up on you. There's not a lot. It's like you're walking along and you fall into a well. You know, you're in the well, and then you have to drag yourself out of it. And then once you're out, you're fine for a while. But you find yourself in the well. So, yeah, it is what it is. Hopefully this year will clear up that. I know what's causing it. I can't really comment on what's causing it. Yeah, hopefully this year we can sort it one way or the other. Stay positive. Focus on the things and get enough sleep. Getting enough sleep is key.
That's true. I can honestly say most of my depression is focused mostly around work.
Yeah. How so? Can you not say?
No, I can say. I don't see why I couldn't. I have spent the last 23 years working in food retail. I am a produce manager for a local grocery store chain.
Mm-hmm.
It is a horrible, miserable job. It, It's a lot of people who take basically a grocery store way too seriously. It's a grocery store. You put the stuff on the shelf. You try to make sure, especially in my department where its quality is key, that you're putting out the best possible quality. It's not rocket scientist. People don't need to lose their absolute minds over it.
Wow. Okay.
It's one of those jobs that started off as being a pretty darn good job that you felt good about. And then over the years, it just kind of went downhill.
Yeah, that's not good. Not good.
Well, it's also one of those things where I started back when I was 16. I'm now just about 40. It was one of those things where I wasn't going to go off to college because I wanted to do something in the computer science area. And all the colleges wanted you to be pretty darn good at math to get into their computer science courses.
Says he running to the microphone. Math, yes.
So I was horrible at math. So I wasn't going into any computer science courses. I took everything that my high school had, which was just pure garbage. So I started off working there part-time, at 16. And I saw a lot of people who, when I first started there, they were getting free, but their healthcare was free. We didn't pay for it. People were getting paid decent money for doing a job that was, it's a halfway easy job to do that you just basically got to get yourself kind of embedded in because we're a union. And I saw a lot of people working there who had degrees and stuff who just weren't able to find any work that, they're now a prime way of making money was working at this grocery store. So I don't know. After a while, I'm just like, I'm here. I'm making a living. I have decent healthcare. What's that?
What's the point of a degree if somebody, if you're doing the same job?
Right.
Yeah. Sorry, carry on.
No, I'm sorry. So I just kind of got myself stuck there. I've always kind of wanted to get out and do something else, but I've just kind of gotten, kind of comfortable. Even in the misery, I've gotten kind of comfortable, After so many years, you start to know lots of people there, so you're friendly with a lot of people. And even though it feels like over the years, people, the management higher up, it seems to, every time they change the rules for everything. They change what they're going to get all excited and crazy about. And, it starts to wear on you after a while. But, I'm at a point where if I go and try and find another job, I have to find another job where I can make what I'm making right now. And then I also have to include the fact of, so over the years, my healthcare is no longer free, but I'm paying for it a lot less than I do than just about everybody else in the United States pays for healthcare.
Yeah, basically, I see where you're coming from.
So to find another job, I need to find a job where I can get into and then at the same time make what I'm making right now and also add in the fact of it. So I'd have to find a job that I make what I'm making plus not have that taking away of the healthcare. So it's, I don't have no problem saying that. I only pay about, I'd say $30 or less a week for my health care, and it's a family plan.
Okay.
Which comes to about $120 a month, which is really cheap, especially for, there's a lot of people who pay probably about $400 a month, if not more.
Okay.
So if I find another job, I got to find one that's also equal in health care and pay, and I'd rather be doing just about anything IT-wise, but kind of stuck at the moment.
And there's no way to transition into IT from your current position or not?
Well, so again, we're in a union. We're a grocery store. We're a union grocery store. So to move into the IT department, the IT department was actually outsourced to a different company. And or they took all the IT people and they brought them into that company type of a thing. I know the guy who's in charge of the IT type stuff for the area. Basically, If I'm going to get to anything IT, I need to probably go get the CompTIA A+. And actually, back in February, I got... So the A+, right now, it's two tests. It's the 1001 and the 1002. Back in February of this year, I did the 1001, which is mostly kind of hardware-related, some general networking-type stuff. The 1002 seems very operating system-focused, and by operating system-focused, 90% of it is Windows stuff, which over, like... I knew a lot more back in like Windows 7 XP days, but now with the 8, 8.1, and 10 days, I really don't know a whole lot because I've been out of it for so long.
Yeah.
Basically, what I need to do is fire up a VM and just kind of shove my head into it for a while and run through some videos on some stuff that they're going to be asking for. And I really just need to get that piece of paper, and that piece of paper at least open up a few doors.
Yeah, but then you're going to be transitioning from your employer and from your union and terms of work and stuff. Yeah, it's a bit of a gamble, all right, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's if I can do it. Keeping with the company I'm on, one of the advantages of, so I live probably, I want to go approximately 60 miles out of Boston. I have no plans on commuting from where I live to Boston, but I could probably, the outskirts of Boston has a lot more IT jobs than, you know, are near where I live. So
that's another thing to factor in. Commute times kills me. 3-hour commute a day.
Oh, damn.
I work from home one of the days, so that's not too bad. But it's essentially you're doing another day and a half, just wasting commute on commute time in the week.
A lot of podcast listening?
Yeah, that's where my interest in podcasting developed from, yeah. Well, that too, but on the other hand, you move to another company, there's no guarantee that you're not going to be dealing with the same, you know, management turnover thing and stuff, so yeah, all in favor of saying following your dreams and do what you love doing and stuff. On the other hand, there's also a pragmatic pragmatic approach. Recognize what you have and are you going to be able to get that sort of, by moving career to do something you love to do, is there going to be an additional commute? Are you going to be able to put bread on the table, you know, stuff like that. It's all very well to say, yeah, I'm grass is greener far away, you know what I mean? Sorry, I'm not very coherent in what I'm trying to say. Is if I was in that situation, I don't know if I would transition from the job that I was in.
No, I'm with you. And that's one of the reasons why I've been here for so long.
Yeah. And also, I don't know. Would, career-wise, is IT the way to go now? Because, people are outsourcing IT departments left, right, and center. They're all going to be offshored. The days of Windows computers, to be honest, are few and far between now. It's only a matter of time before they're like replaced with some sort of Raspberry Pi 5 running Docker container that's centrally sent out from the server. Why would you do it any other way? Just if we are Dockerizing everything in the cloud, why do you go through all this hassle with everybody having Windows PCs and stuff? Just, I don't see the future being Windows anymore.
And that's very true, too. But at the same time, they're going to need somebody, they need one of us physical monkeys to go down there and swap out the Raspberry Pis or whatever.
Yeah, but that's still a far cry from, that's like stocking, vending machine sort of level of skill, as opposed to, would you be better off focusing on managing Docker containers, managing the cloud, managing, getting into Amazon Web Services or the Red Hat equivalent, learning that sort of stuff? Because that you can do from anywhere.
That's true too, but I don't know, what are the first stepping stones to getting into that?
The Linux Academy have an introductional AWS course, which occasionally is up for $10. I normally would steer people away from from free courses or from paid for non-proprietary courses, but in this case it's a proprietary platform anyway. But so that has been very useful to me, because it takes the jargon, and then you realize, hey, when they're talking about the cloud and they're talking about regions, they're just talking about data centers, the rebranded data center. Oh, region is a data center, is it? It is, yes. And your secure, S3 storage, that's just a bunch of disks in a sort of RAID array, probably, that's underneath. That's, you know, an abstraction there. So by just following that course, it gives you a very quick overview of the jargon, and then it takes the scariness of the whole internet and the cloud thing away, and then a lot more comfortable listening to stuff that Tlatu is doing, which will show you how they're physically doing this cloud-based computing and Docker using namespace tricks on the Linux kernel. So all this Linux stuff that you have in your back pocket suddenly becomes very obvious what they're at. So I would, you know, do your certification as well there, but have a look at those courses and see if it is something that spend a little time watching them, and you might think, hey, that's a direction I can go in. Because believe me, there are an awful lot of bluffers in that area now at the minute.
First off, I'm not sure I'll ever reach a point where I can fully understand what Klaatu is saying. I listened to the... I would like to say that some way I could, but I'm kind of off and on with GNU World Order, because there are times when I start to listen and then my mind starts to kind of drift away, and I go, I feel like I knew some of that, but not enough to fully grasp what I'm hearing. This man is on a whole other level. Second off, I always wanted to get a coffee mug that's just said, I saw it a while back, but I still want to grab it. It says the cloud is just somebody else's computer, and it's got a little picture of a cloud on it. I want to see if I can find a link to them. I'd love to do something, and I'm not sure whether if I just go for the A+ exam to have that in my pocket, because that's certifications are one of those things where you can kind of walk up and kind of hand to somebody and say, hey, look at that. I can do this. And I don't have a degree of computer science in my pocket to be able to do that too. I actually went to my local community college and got a certificate in computer repair, which was basically supposed to be a kind of a way to get you to the A+ exam. The problem being, I finished that exam right about the same time I got promoted at my other job, and then the promotion in that job, so I basically became a produce department head or a produce manager around the same time I finished those courses and classes, and I was I got promoted, and I got sent to a store that was about an hour away from where I live on a good day. So I became very involved in my new position and stuff, and this kind of fell by the wayside. And as far as A+ stuff kind of goes, again, you're talking about in 2009, Windows 7 just came to be. So it's all kind of passed. All that knowledge is now almost useless, but not necessarily useless, but almost useless. I'd love to do something more. I'd love to get either a networking or Cisco, because I really like the idea of I like networking. I think networking is cool. Then again, I can't necessarily do a remote job doing networking, which is kind of the dream.
Well, that seems very strange to me. We have a department that says, if my employees can't work remote, then they're not qualified to be network people. that's their philosophy, that everything should be manageable remotely. You should never have any piece of equipment that is not remotely manageable. There's a big change coming in that as well. If you think in networking, the whole concept of how networking has been done and basically how we've been taught in the past, mostly the Cisco command line interface, the days of that is numbered as well. I'm looking at software defined networking. There's a lot of talk about it, and that's really becoming something that you should also have a look into and have a exploration of.
Yeah, that is true.
You got EPGs coming up. What are they called again? Endpoint groups. That's it. Yeah. Application control endpoint groups. So basically, the whole thing is running on virtual servers and commodity servers as well. And then you control it. You control basically by having what seems to be like a computer program of if this then that. And the way they wire up data centers now using their Spine and Leaf technology. Very interesting as well. Completely new way of, seems like a new way of doing stuff to get maximum throughput, guaranteed throughput. Simplification of the network, stuff like that. All going to be changing very, very soon. Well, that's the thing with a career in IT. If you want a career in IT, you need to expect that the stuff that you know now will be obsolete in 2 years, which is why I like the fact that there's so much Unix stuff, because even though things are changing, at the end of the day, Amazon may be calling it one thing, but under the hood, it's just a Postgres database. Or they might be calling it something else, but under the hood, it's just routing tables. But you have to be prepared to relearn everything for 2 years, what you need to know. And remember, you only need to be one step ahead of everybody else. One Google search ahead of the next guy. Or DuckDuckGo in this case. I just need to nip upstairs and get a screwdriver. I'll be back in about 5.
I think I'm going to nip upstairs and start another cup of coffee.
Good plan.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Can you hear me?
I can't. I can hear you. How do I sound?
You sound great, Netminer. How's things going?
Well, I have a back kicking up, but I'm doing pretty good otherwise.
Yeah, I suffer from back problems, so I know what that feels like. Anyone else on with us at the moment?
I'd guess Honky is just streaming.
It was around about an hour ago when I bobbed in just to check my sound, and it wasn't working. And then I've just twigged why it wasn't working, because I've got a microphone mute key set, hotkey set up on my computer, and my mic was muted, so that's why I was having problems.
Yeah, well, I have a few problems myself sometimes. Half the time I'll boot up and there'll be a patch to mumble or something, and I have to reinitialize.
Yeah. Well, when we record Mintcast, we don't use push to talk. We just have a mute key that we set, so we use voice activated. So when I'd gone in to change it to push to talk, I'd forgotten my mic might actually be quietened.
By the way,
yeah.
Yeah, I've got something to say about Vox, you know, speech activated.
All right, yeah, go on.
I was listening to YouTube and somebody was doing some SDR, software defined radio, and he found this unusual pattern that he recorded. Evidently, somebody had fallen asleep with voice activation enabled.
So it recorded all their sleep talk.
So he was broadcasting over the ham radio his snores.
That's a good one. I like that.
Hi, Tony. Did you get your thing connected?
I was just saying to Netminer, what it was, I've got a hotkey set up to mute my mic for when we do the Mintcast recording, because we don't use push to talk, we use voice activation. And for some reason, my mic was still muted.
You set up push to talk here, I imagine.
I have. I've got my space bar set up as the push to talk key.
Okay, cool. I'm going to be doing some dismantling of shells.
I'm going to disappear and go and get something to eat. But like I said, I just bobbed in just to check everything was working again. So I'll put the mute sign up on my lips and I'll be back about midday.
Well, happy new year if I don't manage to bump into you. I have a list that needs to be processed today.
Right. So you're not going to be on this afternoon then.
No, I'm going to be listening. I'll be pottering away here in the back room. We have a bathroom upstairs and their builders are coming in next week. So in order for that, everything that's in the attic needs to move down. In order for that, there needs to be space made out here. In order for that, blah, 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 blah. You know, big, long, long list of stuff that needs to be done.
All right.
So I'll be listening. But anyway, Happy New Year. Are you going to Fostem at all, are you?
No, I'm not going to Fostem. Nah. It's not on my calendar.
It was nice to meet up with you at Odd Camp in person.
Yeah, I put a call out on the Odd Camp Discord page to tell them I was going to be around about 12 o'clock, so there might be a few Odd Campers on here later.
Ah, oh, very good, very good.
Do you know if Dave's joining at some stage during the day?
Traditionally, he doesn't. No, he has a life.
He's not allowed to do that.
He's not. No, that's the one day of the year when he gets off. Yeah. Although that said, I have two shows that he needs to process later on today, so I'll do those as well. Okay, I'm going to go get a screwdriver. Talk to you later.
All right. Talk to you later again. Bye.
Hello, Poppy.
Hello,
Poppy.
How you doing?
Hello.
Can you hear me? Okay.
Yes, we can hear you, and you sound very professional. It's Sunday morning. The snoozy sound.
Welcome to the snoozy sound of Hacko Public Radio. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I'm working here in the back room. I'm trying to convince my daughter to do a HPR show, but she refuses to do it. It's only a matter of time, though.
I agree. She should totally do it.
How is life in the Ubuntu community?
Quiet at the moment over Christmas. So Canonical shuts down for 2 weeks over Christmas. We're very lucky in that regard. And that means most of the IRC channels and mailing lists and everything are pretty quiet over Christmas. Everyone goes away. In fact, someone put an announcement on one of the forums that said, FYI, Canonical shuts down for 2 weeks. If you see any Canonical employees, feel free to tell them to get lost.
Yeah, very good, very good. Sorry, I was laughing off, pushed to laugh. No, excellent. We have the same as well. All my communication channels have just gone completely quiet. And the Ubuntu podcast is also off.
Yeah, we're on a break. Yeah, we're on a break until we go out for curry. It's nicely timed, actually, because Mark obviously has had a baby, and that means he's got other things to focus on.
Oh yes. Tell me, did everything go okay with the birth?
Yes, everything is good. Little baby girl, everything's cool. Our priority is obviously the podcast, and whether Mark will be able to find time and quiet room in order to do the recording, I just don't know. So mm-hmm. It may well be we don't come back next year, or if we do, maybe Mark's in it, maybe he's not, maybe we record it differently. I don't know. That's some one of the things I like about it is we don't have to commit. You know, we can. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things I feel bad for you, because, you know, this commitment that HPR has to put out these episodes constantly, and I worry that you don't have this cue, and you know, we can relax and just like say, oh, we'll be back when we're back, and you know.
Yeah, well, with us it's I used to really panic about that at the beginning, but then when we took the commitment that we'll keep doing it until we don't have any more shows, and then when we don't have any more shows, we'll, you know, like curry night, we'll call it a night and say thank you very much to the community and close down and shutter the place up and make sure everything is sorted. But thankfully, you know, people leave, but thankfully also people come back into the community. So there, anytime there's a call for shows, then people seem to step up to the mark. So that's great.
Nice.
I try not to worry about it, basically. I now have Dave and Mr. X, who've got two Raspberry Pis, who flash lights as soon as the cube falls below a certain level, and then they start panicking for me. You know, outsource the panic. Super. That's what you need to do.
Oh, I love that. I love the idea of having a Raspberry Pi telling you when things are going south.
Yeah, it's handy. I know we've also increased it so that we try and keep 2 weeks of the queue full. So that kind of works out okay. And actually, after so many years, I get a feeling for when it's going to be quiet and when it's not going to be quiet. So it tends to
start geeing people along to get them.
Yeah, and I kind of get worried if the queue is low at particular times when I know that people will be start recording shows. I don't worry too much about it. But a low queue going into the summer in the Northern Hemisphere, that's something you need to tackle straight away.
I always think I'd love to do one of these, but I never feel like I know enough to be able to do well. I never feel like I'm like a technical expert enough. I listen to some of them and I think, wow, these guys are like, their brains are made of ones and zeros, and I don't have the technical capability to do this stuff.
This is one of the occasions where I'm glad I'm able to come over and respond to that, because if I heard you coming out with that on your own show, I would go, are you mental? You're one of the most technically competent people we know in the community.
No, I'm really not.
If you're afraid of doing a podcast, come on.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? It's just that, I guess it's that, I don't know, that blocker. Once you get over that, and once you record a couple, I'm sure it's fine. But I could sit here and stare out the window and think, what would I talk about, you know, and what would I talk about that people don't already know? Like, I could talk about something that I do in my day job, but then I'd be thinking, but all these people know all of this, or they've heard all this before, or they've seen it, or I'll come across as just a shill, or, you know, what? I just don't know what I would talk about that people would find interesting. That's the problem.
For a start, for somebody who I can not even vision not talking the whole time.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that you even have a silent moment in your day, but okay.
Really? Oh, wow.
This is amazing. I would never have put you down as somebody who would be nervous about recording a HBR show.
Now, it's funny you should say that. I think it's one of those things that we have perceptions of what other people are like. And I recently revealed to the in-laws, we were sat around having Sunday lunch. And I can't remember what it was. We were talking about going social events or something, parties or something. And I revealed to them that I absolutely hate social events. I hate being around other people, especially people I don't know. I really, really hate it. It's a personal pet hate. I feel really uncomfortable, and I'm rather happy in my own company, just sitting on my own. And I'd rather, like, the rest of the family go to a party and I stay at home. And that extends to standing on stage and like giving a talk. I'm fine talking to a bunch of people on a stage, like giving a presentation or something, but being in the same room with that same like 500 people or whatever it is, and having to actually talk to them personally one-to-one is a real personal fear. And those kind of things, when I explain them, they were like, but you love standing on stage and giving these talks. I'm like, yeah, I do, but it's frightening doing it. It's absolutely frightening doing it. And I think that's the thing, that people perceive you have a different outgoing, you know, visible personality than the one that's actually in your head.
Yeah. Yet that's so much of that. I have personally, you're describing my own myself as well. Even when I was young, I would have no problem going in front of a stage of hundreds of people singing or doing drama or something, but talking to those same people would just turn.
It's weird, isn't it?
And I have this thing, you know, when you go to Odd Camp or Lug Radio, as it was back in the day, standing outside with a telephone, telephoning my wife, and it's now become a tradition where you go, what the hell am I doing here? Why am I here? what, these people don't know me. I'm, why am I actively going to a social event when I normally wouldn't, you know, the last thing that I wanted to do.
Yeah, I feel the same way at Old Camp, actually. Old Camp's weird because there's a bunch of friends who I get on well with.
Exactly.
But there's also a bunch, yeah, who I would quite happily stand in the bar with the entire, you know, entirety of Old Camp and just stand in the bar and chat to. And there are also, you know, complete strangers who I don't avoid, but I don't know them. And so there's this awkward conversation. Well, it's awkward for me. I don't think it's, well, it may be awkward for them as well, but I have people coming up to me and say, oh, I enjoy your podcast or whatever it is. And I say, thank you. And I have no idea who these people are, but they know who I am. I'm sure you get the same thing. People know who Ken Fallon is and they'll come and say hello. I mean, I guess your face isn't all over the place as much.
No, I'm not as famous as you. Now, let's. In fact, my goal in life is to be less famous than anybody. Just
okay.
So happens that I'm here. I would prefer not to be, but yeah.
But when I was at Old Camp most recently, the one in where the hell was it? Manchester.
Manchester.
That's it.
Pretty city, actually.
It was very nice. It was a really good one this year. I found myself going into a room and sitting right at the back or sitting at the edge, consuming the content, listening, you know, maybe engaging, maybe asking a question here or there, and then getting up and walking out like straight away. I would avoid all the other people in the room. And it's not that I don't like them or I have any reason not to want to speak to any of them. It's just personally, I find it really hard to talk to those people, to anyone who is, you know, a stranger or, you know, internet friend.
Yeah, it is. No, I completely get what you're on about. I find, though, that when I'm in the Old Camp mode, then I switch into the Old Camp mode. It's fine. But what freaks me out is if I'm in like a work mode or something, and then I meet somebody from the, you know, HPR sort of life, then I need to completely reboot that thing. Probably it's different for you because you're working for Canonical now, but that you're always in the Old Camp mode.
Actually, I did see a bit of that. I was at a company event and we invited some people to, where was it? Seattle, I think. No, Montreal. And we'd all flown out there with a bunch of people, and I didn't recognize the name of one of them as being someone who I've hung out with at Lug Radio Live and Old Camp like 10 years ago or whenever it was. And he walked in the room and I was in work mode, and this guy walks in and I think, oh my God, I've had beer with that guy. I recognize him. And I'd actually invited him to, and not realizing, not putting two and two together and putting the names together, because, you know, it's a nickname. Oh my God, it's you. And so it was great because we were having social time, and, you know, in the evenings we were having, during the day being all professional. But that context, which you have to do, oh, hang on, this person is from another context. I've got to switch into personal life mode or Old Camp mode, you know, internet weirdo mode or whatever it is.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because my daughter is now listening to the live stream outside and she won't hear this for another 7 seconds. But hang on, you never listen to me normally during the day. What the hell are you doing listening to me on the HPR? Yeah, but you're different on HPR. Okay, fair enough. She's turned up. The 7 seconds has passed. Say hi. It's Poppy.
What?
It's Poppy. That guy there, look. P-O-P-E-Y.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Sinead.
Hi, I'm Sinead.
I also don't want to do a HBR show.
I never said that.
Okay.
Hello, Sinead.
She won't hear the hello for another 7 seconds because...
I heard it.
Okay. All
right. I love the name Sinead.
Hi.
Yeah. Beautiful.
Beautiful name. Okay, if you don't HPR, how about a Linux Lug cast?
Hi, Ned Miner.
Hello. Sorry, you broke up a little bit there. I didn't hear a whole sentence.
I think he's asking, would you do a Linux Lug cast then?
I'll go on anything. See, this is the difference. The difference between going on a what you might call a traditional podcast where other people are presenting and you're a guest is they just ask you questions and you just, it's like a chat, right? And I could do that. That's fine. In fact, I did it with Rocco does his community spotlight podcast, and he contacted me and said, hey, do you want to go on this thing? And I said, yeah, it'd be fine. It was great. And he said, I've got a set of questions that I'll send to you. And I said, no, don't bother. Don't send me questions. I quite like being thrown questions cold. And there's nothing, you know, if I don't want to answer it, I won't answer it. And if I do, then I'll answer it. And I quite like that. I quite like the spontaneity of a non-scripted, you know, set of questions. But that's just like a conversation with a friend, an internet friend. Whereas HPR is very different. Like, and I did one with Yannick on HPR, two episodes where he interviewed me. And that, again, was just like a podcast. Yeah. But me cold, opening a microphone and then recording it, and then someone, me or someone, doing the levels and audio editing and then putting it out is a very different prospect.
No, you just press record. There's something you want to say, you press record, you fill out the form and you send it in. No editing, no nothing. This is procrastination is the biggest enemy of HBR, you know. If people stopped procrastinating, you hold off a sec. And sorry, yes, my daughter now has decided to help me drilling. So you hold off.
Drilling noises are always good on a podcast. It's always good to hear drilling noises in the background because it makes the listener think, what are they drilling? What are they doing?
It doesn't necessarily have to be technical, you know. It can just be a soundscape or the podcast did a family outing where they were doing geocaching. The HPR is of interest to hackers. That can be anything.
Right, that's true.
And by the way, your thing on snap packages would be just perfect. And you are like a snap package expert, so yeah.
Yeah, I think I've got more snaps in the store under my name than anyone. I think I've got like 200 in the store or something stupid. So yeah, I should be able to speak with some level of authority. But the reason I don't want to do that is that I feel like that would be shilling, even though it is my job to shill because I'm a developer advocate for Snapcraft. So that actually is my job.
Yeah, but on the other hand, if I put out a request right now officially from the HPR community for a show based on a series based on Snapcraft, then please can you do that and publish it here? That doesn't fall under the heading of shilling. That falls under the heading of sharing your projects. I see zero wrong with that. And when I've interviewed people at FOSDEM, I've said to them, look, guys, if you've got cool and interesting stuff coming up, use HPR as a release for that. If there's too much of it, then somebody will mention it on the mailing list and say, guys, we're getting too much of this crap. Maybe we should move it off somewhere else. But right now I see if you've been working on a project for 6 months or a year or whatever, and you want to show people how to use it, the source code is free and open source. It's of interest to hackers. Then you're done.
Okay. I'll reconsider it then.
Shill away, sir.
By the way, did you say push to laugh earlier? I really like that phrase.
Yes, we have to push to laugh here because push to chuckle is stolen from the You Random podcast. They push to chuckle quite a lot.
Oh, I love that. That's really cute.
Actually, I was shilling for the Linux Lugcast to have the young lady come aboard one day.
I feel terrible now.
They actually want you on the Linux Lugcast podcast.
On the what?
On the Linux Lugcast podcast. It's a podcast. It's a bit like HPR, only it's live and it's every month. And a Lugcast is a Linux user group. So they have like a virtual one for people who don't have a group locally. And you come on to the Mumble and then you have a chat and stuff.
Why do you want me on?
Yes, we have entirely too many gentlemen and not enough ladies, please.
Yeah, too many gentlemen, not enough ladies. That is a problem on HBR as well, yeah.
I was half serious, but I'll go to three quarters if the lady wants to join us.
They do use Linux a lot because I set up a Raspberry Pi for them, and then rather than put a UI on it, they have to navigate using the console in order to play anything.
Well, I'm doing, and I've got now two Linux machines up. There is a local group, and by the way, we're twice a month, but I'm,
yeah, sorry, it's twice a month, obviously.
I'm senior Indian. I don't host. I just sit there in the background in case somebody wants to find something about ancient Linux, ancient Unix technology, computer technology, ARPANET, ChaosNet, whatever.
All topics that are of interest to hackers, there you go.
Yeah, well, I should do a little practice here. Get my Audacity up, and then after I practice a little bit with Audacity, maybe I'll have the audacity to make a subject.
Ba-doom.
Also, it's later on, I'm planning on getting into software-defined radio, and that's that may be something that I'll dig into deep enough to be worth responding to.
Yeah, we do have a ham radio series on there, so pop them on underneath that. SDR, software defined radio, is always interesting, I think.
Well, I'm not so much ham as random other stuff. Just have to decide where to break in and how much to tear open the wallet.
Poppy, are you going to FOSDEM by any chance?
Poppy is on the side, muted.
Yeah, he could very well now be scrambling back to the microphone.
Ken, apologies to the lady. I did not want to chase her away.
No, she's right here. I have her slaving away. I fully believe in child labor. And he's calling you a lady. You see, I would call you a brat, personally. But... Whack!
I disagree.
No, it'd take more than that to scare her away now, truth be told. So how is life with you, Netminer?
Oh, my back's kicking up. My cat's snoring.
Ow!
Otherwise, I'm getting on pretty good.
No, I've had a long history of sore backs. Not good, not good, nothing. Not good at all. Now I need to start moving shelves and stuff. In order to move a shelf, we need to move the desks. Well, where to move the desks to? Because there's no space here. Anyway, this will be a puzzle. If I'm quiet, you know why.
So, Netminer, do you go to physical Linux user groups as well as the virtual ones online?
Well, I used to, back in the days when I was running Windows 7. Find ironic. But they've been mucking with the subway between my area and MIT, where the users group is, so I haven't gone in a while.
Because I don't drive. Still active?
I haven't checked. Boston Linux users group. Haven't checked recently. I've been to. Used to go to regular meetings and install fests and stuff. Funny thing is, now that I'm really using Linux, I haven't gone.
Funny how I think a lot of Linux user groups have changed in some ways, that they were super popular when it was difficult to install Linux and difficult to get yourself up and running with the applications you need. And now it's a lot easier to install Linux. I think the need for a Linux user group and having a support group of real physical people nearby to actually get the thing installed. Obviously, you know, you still have technical problems that need solving, but the actual getting over the initial hump of getting it installed is kind of not a necessity as much anymore, perhaps.
No, I've been wrestling with everything from single core P4s to early AMD 64, and I've been able to do a lot of stuff on my own as far as the install goes. Although the latest system was a bit of a trick trying to get a Linux that would install on it. Optimus video graphics was the problem.
Yeah, it seems video cards are often the sticker at the moment, and not just for like installs, but for updates as well. You know, having an update that breaks your video card, you know, breaks the display, so you get I don't know, 1024 by 768, or even worse, a black screen is something that we still need to do better at.
Well, I was installing it to a laptop, and before I had the NVIDIA Xorg installed, it was getting all kinds of power events that it was not prepared to take, and it took me a while searching through about a dozen different distros to find one. Finally found Linux Lite, would get installed, and then I could install the Optimus driver set. Now, that may change with version 5 Linux kernels that have more Optimus support built in or what have you. But it was a little tricky. Drove me crazy for about a week.
Yeah, I can imagine. Can't remember the last time I went to my local Linux user group. But I think I think most of them were social things, probably about a year ago, I think.
Well, I'm on the fringe of the Boston area, what you might call reasonable public transportation. Takes me maybe an hour and a half to get into the core of Boston from here. So when they were screwing with that, it made the users group a lot more difficult to get to. I'm also waiting somewhat on the Pi 4 to age a bit.
What, for the price to come down?
No, for the capability to go up a little bit. The video side is still a little weak, I think. Also, I'd like to see Raspberry and go 64-bit.
What do you see as the benefit of Raspberry Pi being 64-bit?
That was my question.
8 gig. The reason the 8 gig Pi didn't come out is that Raspberry is 32-bit.
Yeah, but the thing going to break all the i32 stuff.
They'll then have to have two separate images as well. One for the 32-bit only devices and one for the 64-bit capable ones. And I know they quite like having just download this one image and it works on any Pi kind of thing. Besides which, who needs 8 gig in a Raspberry Pi?
I do, because we're using Raspberry Pis as main PCs now.
Why? It's like I've never understood why. I mean, okay, they're low cost, but they're super inconvenient to use as a computer when you compare it with like a laptop, for example.
Nope, I disagree. Because and this is one of the major reasons I have issues with the way the Linux development model is done. People in the Linux development model are developers who have laptops and who, for their daily grind, are focused on their own use cases. There are thousands upon thousands of workers out there who fill in order forms on their screens and they're using terminals. It's just a device that's there. So here's what you have. Central location blasts out to Raspberry Pis. I've already done a few HBR episodes. You will not be surprised to hear about this. Downloads the image, changes the keys, blasts them out, and you've got little SD cards running your generic terminals. Then you come along with Ansible, and you blast out all the updates to these things. They break, not a problem. You go out, you have somebody trained. This is what a Raspberry Pi looks like. Here are the four different connectors. If anything goes wrong, you take off this connector and you put in this new one. End of story. They're completely a usable device for the majority of business cases.
I don't believe majority of business cases. I believe some business cases for normal users.
As a European infrastructure manager for a major multinational for 5 years, I guarantee you 80 to 90% of the people using computers at that time would be more than sufficient having a Raspberry Pi. In fact, it would be a lot better simply because they're asked on a factory floor. They're filling in the form. You can lock it down so that that's all that happens on that. And then if they want to go play a game in their own time, take out the SD card, put in this SD card, reboot it. You're not on our network. You can play the game. You can do whatever you want. But when you're finished, put back in the company one, and it'll just blow it down. So it becomes a commodity. Somebody going in, taking product from this side, and I don't mean to demean the work that these people are doing. Far from it. You know, the place I worked, they were doing life support equipment, and it was critically important that they knew what they were doing and that they logged what they were doing. And for that, a reliable computer is all you need. And that therein is a Raspberry Pi.
Sure. And for that use case, fine. But not everyone does that kind of work. And I'm not talking about developers. I'm just talking about office workers, general office workers.
Majority of office workers would also get away with doing it because you're connecting into a remote PC, running Ubuntu on your own personal cloud, obviously. But who is processing stuff locally on the machine now? You're using Jira?
A lot of people process stuff on their local machine because they want the portability. They want to be able to use it anywhere and sit on the train and process this stuff and not have to be connected in order to do their work.
I agree with you, Popey.
No, you guys, from a board, where have one area where computer users, Linux has not won the desktop. Name that one area. As in office IT computing. Because nobody has insight into what's going on. The reason being that Linux developers, Linux users are not in there because they're prevented from using Linux in their working environment. Therefore, it's a complete black hole to people.
So the place I worked immediately before Canonical, every single person had a Dell laptop. There might be some people who had desktops, but the vast majority had Dell laptops. And this was a multi-story building with many hundreds of people. And the applications they were running absolutely would not run remotely. They were local applications. There's no way you could run them optimally on a remote machine. And people want to be able to work, pick up their laptop and go and work somewhere else, which when you've got a Raspberry Pi that's tethered to a keyboard and display, that's just not possible.
Yeah, you've just got to think about...
I think you're missing the point here. Yeah, first of all, I would question that looking at what most people are using. Most people are using email. Most people are using Excel. Most people are using some application like Word.
No, people are using corporate applications which do not run well remotely.
Okay, well then that I would gesture is not the norm for the majority of people.
The software they're using is SAP, and it's significant use in every one of the companies in the top 100.
I would give you that, yes. But I would also argue that SAP, the functionality provided by that software could equally be provided by a central server that goes.
Well, it is a central server.
It is a
central server, and you use a client-side GUI to connect to it. But what people often did in the office that I worked in is you would run some kind of job on the SAP system and then download a chunk of data and then sit and process it locally in Excel or some other desktop application. And there was very tight integration between those desktop applications and the SAP system at the back end. And so you can't just replace the client, the laptop, with Linux, because Linux didn't have Microsoft Office, which had tight integration with SAP. And so it was just a non-starter because the integration wasn't there. And so the people who needed those features just couldn't do their job if they were swapped out with Linux.
Yeah, but what I'm saying to you is this is the inevitable catch-22 situation. But if you relook at that as a greenfield IT department going, guys, I want to move where the processing is done on the cloud, like every other, that you have to admit that is the trend that's happening now at the minute. And even Ubuntu are pushing that with your services.
And SAP are now as well.
So why, exactly, as maybe, I'm not an expert on SAP, thankfully. Although JWP is, so he would be able to comment on that. JWP, you owe me a show on SAP and running it in the cloud. So for the majority of people who would be at a station, fixed working point, that they're not mobile, that they don't need a laptop, then having a Raspberry Pi is a perfectly viable alternative. For other people, having a Chromebook is a perfectly viable alternative. Because you log in and you get to the network. That's administration-wise, I just see that a lot easier.
Yeah, Sam, I'm sure it is. Yeah.
Okay, I now need to I need to screw this bookshelf to the wall because my daughter is holding it up for the last 5 minutes. But this is such an engaging conversation.
We're 5 minutes to the hour. Who becomes 2020 on the hour? I can't. Oh, these are Zulu time, aren't they?
If you go to there's a link on your website. Countdown and time thing. It's in 4 minutes. It's going to be small regions of Russia, Tawara, Mayuro, Yaren in 4 minutes. And then the next one's an hour after that. And then the next one's a half hour after that. Okay, we need a bracket.
You're jumping the gun a bit.
Can you hear me, guys?
Yep.
How are you doing, Alan?
Super. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. I've been getting into my new hobby.
Uh-oh. What's this then?
I've started collecting and restoring Matchbox cars from my youth.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's quite fun, actually.
What do you do to restore them? Like putting new wheels on them or painting them or what?
Yeah, stripping them down, stripping the paint off, repainting them. The whole works. You can replace the wheels on the slightly older super fast models. The original wheels variants are harder to change the wheels on, but most people actually like them anyway, so they don't bother. But yeah, it's quite fun.
Where'd you pick up the ones that need tender loving care? Car boot sales, eBay?
Car boot sales, eBay, swap meets, all sorts of stuff.
And do car boot sales, like, is it you walk around and see someone who's got like a cardboard box full of cars and you just job lot by them, or do you cherry pick knowing which models are the ones you want to get?
It just depends on how the seller's doing it. Some sellers will have a box full of old cars, Corgi, Matchbox, that kind of stuff, and they'll say 50p each or five for so much or whatever. And you can just route through it and pick out the ones you want.
And do you know which ones? Is it like a nostalgic thing? You're thinking about the ones that you had as a kid or the cars that were, you know, in films that you watched as a kid, like a Bond car or something? Or is it just like whichever one's in decent nick that you know, he's still got all four wheels and still got a steering wheel and the bumpers haven't been chewed off by a dog or something?
Actually, sometimes the more extreme the condition of the vehicle is, the more of a challenge to restore them. If you go on YouTube, some of the restorers can bring back to life things that have been buried in the ground for like 30 years.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah,
carry on.
I was going to say, for me, it's actually a chance to collect the cars that I could never afford when I was a kid. I know they were only just over 2 shillings when I was a lad, but that was a lot of money to us because we weren't exactly rich. So even a Matchbox car was quite an expensive item. So for me, it's about getting older things that I could never afford when I was a little.
Nice. So how much time does it take to restore one, and do you do it all in one session, or do you have like a workshop where you have to keep coming back to the car and it's sat there nagging at you saying, fix me, Tony, fix me?
Yeah, you can't. I've got a box full of various cars in various conditions waiting to be restored at the moment. I've only actually done two or three because I only started a couple of months ago. The first one I did was a Matchbox model of a Mark 10 Jag.
Oh, nice.
And it is. It's really cool. It's an interesting hobby. And there's different ways of doing things. Some people decide to drill out the little posts and use screws to hold them back together. Other people glue them back together. You know, various different ways of doing it.
Is that because initially they were riveted together?
Well, with Matchbox, they had a little post in it. And then after they put the base on, they used some kind of machine to mushroom out this post that then held the base in place. So it's not exactly a rivet. With Corgi, they either riveted them or screwed them.
And do people get funny about the fact that you're not keeping them in the way they were originally? Like, if you replace them with screws and you're repainting them, it's not the genuine original lead paint? Or are people just happy to see these things, you know, looking better than they did?
Believe it or not, even Matchbox back in the 50s didn't use lead paint. There was already people saying lead paint was bad, so they used paints that didn't contain lead. But there are some people who would prefer just to leave them in the original condition. There are some people who only collect perfect condition models, and they'll pay a fortune for them. These other people like me, you know, I've been collecting, so if I've got a good example, even if it's play worn, I'll just stick it in the collection and I won't restore that. But
the phrase for one that's been used is play worn? Is like where a kid's been playing with it?
Yeah, yeah. So and you'll get various states of play worn. Some play worn can be there's no paint left on it. And the screens are cracked and all sorts. Other people, you know, other times you'll get play. I've got a couple of play worn ones sat in front of me now. And for their age, which is over 50 years old, some of them nearly 60 years old, you'd think, wow, how's that managed to survive in that condition for that long?
So what chemicals do you use to remove the paint? And is there any particular type of paint you put back on it? Do you put the same colour or different or what?
Sometimes you'll try and match the colour. If you've got an airbrush, then that's a lot easier. If you're using rattle cans, you've just got to go with whatever you can buy off the shelf. But you try and just do as best match as you can. But paint them up. You don't always have to. The thing is, once you start restoring it, it becomes what they call a code 3, which has been altered from the original manufacturer. So if you're honest about these things, they're never worth as much as a mint condition original car that's not been touched, that comes in its box. There are people who try to pass off restored models as original untouched, but, you know, there's ways of telling whether they've been touched up and things like that. Oh, just a minute, I've got a knock on the door. Sorry about that, Alan. It was a posting.
No worries. So do you rub the cars down with sandpaper, or do you use chemicals or whatever to get the old paint off?
I've been using caustic soda to strip the paint.
Oh, wow.
But you've got to be careful with it. You know, even some of the paint strippers that you buy in B&Q and things like that, you've got to wear masks and be very careful when you're doing it.
Would you dunk it in a bath, or do you, like, use it? I mean, a bath, not as in the bath, as in, like, a container containing a small amount of this.
Yeah, I've got a large old pickle jar that I put the boiling water in, cover the model, and then gradually add a couple of teaspoons of the caustic soda, and it bubbles away. And sometimes it'll strip the paint within 5 or 6 minutes.
Oh, wow.
Depending on the paint. Although sometimes you do get child over-painted models. They've put mum's nail varnish all over them, and that can take a little bit longer.
And like, you take it out and it's just bare metal underneath, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and then depending on the condition of the model, it'll show up if there's any corrosion, any pits and things like that. So you then polish it up. You can use these little handheld multi-tools, you know, the Dremels and things like that, to polish it up with the little brass wire wheels. And then If you then give it an undercoat with a spray can, it shows up where you may need to fill it or repair any damage.
Gotcha.
Some people actually like to, you know, in America and in this country, they get really serious about it, particularly with the Hot Wheels ones. They'll actually do their own nickel plating, and then they use what they call spectroflame colours, which show through the metal.
Wow.
Yeah, it's quite a serious hobby for a lot of people. So,
and there you two guys have just wasted a perfectly good HBR episode. Thank you very much.
Sorry about that, Ken. I was thinking of actually recording an episode.
You totally should. Yes. Like, starting from the point of, like, the life cycle of the car. If you talk, like, if you could do a bit of outdoor recording of you walking around a car boot sale and the chink of you rummaging through a car. I was just picturing it as you were telling it, rummaging through a box, yeah, like getting the car and then taking it back and, you know, boiling the kettle to fill up the jar with water and stuff. I've got it in my mind, yeah. But I think, you know, adding a little bit of that would be great.
Funnily enough, there's a big toy and hobby fair in Blackpool in a couple of weekends' time. In fact, two weeks on Saturday that I'm going to, and so I might actually do some recording while I'm there, having a look round, see what they've got. I don't know whether they're going to be doing any swaps, but I've got quite a few that I could take with me for swaps, and then come back and talk about it on the show. I haven't actually been to any car boots yet, because when I started a couple of months ago, most of the car boots had shut down for the winter. I'm just hoping, opening some stuff that I got off eBay, which is car related.
Oh, that's handy. More sound effects for the HPR episode.
Nice little bubble wrap. This one's come from China, so I'm suspecting it's one of those UV glue containers.
What's UV glue?
Go on eBay, type in UV glue, and it'll come up. The original one is a product called Bondic. It was actually developed for the dental industry 30 years ago. I was talking to my dentist about it. And he says they don't use it anymore because it's the UV light that they used to use it to cure the fillings is too strong, so they have to use a blue light version now. But it turned out that it was so good they turned it into a product for the repair and model industry. I was correct. You can't hear this because I've got on push to talk, but I'm actually unwrapping bubble wrap at the moment of the model.
Yeah, we could. I don't think you do have it on push to talk.
Oh, I thought I did have it on push to talk. Well, it must have reset. Funny thing is, this particular model that I ordered off eBay, I paid £10 for it with postage. And funnily enough, I bought a job lot of cars for spare and repair. And there was the same model, slightly different variant of it, in the batch that I bought, and it's actually in better condition, and I only paid £2 for it.
Nice.
So I've now got two versions of the same model, although looking at them, one is the one with the slightly different configuration. Yeah, it's a little fire rescue tender with the ladders that was made in 1953, and there's a couple of different variants, and one you can see through the legs of the driver, and the one that I've just had delivered you can't. And yeah, nice little model. Don't know why push to talk's not working. working. So what have you been up to, Alan?
Over Christmas? Not a huge amount. We've been doing this 8-bit versus thing, me and Martin, where we play old video games from the past. It's all started in the Ubuntu Podcast Telegram channel where myself and Martin had a brief argument about how one 8-bit computer was better than the other. And someone suggested that we each play those games and live stream it. And someone else said, yes, I will watch that. And we were like, okay, well, yeah, let's do that then. So we set up this thing called 8-bit versus. And the premise is, I was a fan of the Sinclair Spectrum and Martin was a fan of the Commodore 64. But in this, we get to play each other's platform. So first off, I get to play a game of Martin's choosing, but I get to play on the Commodore and he gets to play on the Spectrum. And in another round, I choose a game and he gets to play again on the Spectrum and I get to play on the Commodore. So we each get to choose some of our favorite games from the past and get each other. And then at the end of it, we decide which one was better. And it started off as just an idea that we had back in, I think, May of this year. And it's taken a long time for us to get going. We only started a couple of weeks ago. And part of the problem is we wanted to be able to do this remotely from each other. And we wanted to be able to see what the other person was doing. So, for example, Martin is playing a Commodore 64 game and I want to be able to see that. Or I'm playing a Spectrum game and he needs to be able to see that while we're simultaneously streaming out to YouTube or Twitch or whatever. And that, being able to do that is actually quite hard. Now, I hear people are now shouting at their clients, well, you could just share your screen, or you could just share your, you know, you could use any one of the many screen sharing tools. They all suck because they all have either something on the screen which overlays on top with their branding on, which is useless, or the latency is really terrible. And by terrible, I mean, like, someone's playing a game and their character dies. And they'll go, oh, you know, that, oh dear, oh, my character died. And then 5 seconds later, the other person watching goes, oh no, you died. And it looks terrible when you play that back, having like a 5 second delay between the person dying. I mean, you know what it's like when you're streaming HPR to another room. There's a 7 second delay and that's just audio and we're sending video. So Martin wrote, a tool called Simple Stream. And it's anything but simple. But the idea is you run this Simple Stream script, you click on a window, and the other person runs the other end of it, and it sends that data compressed over the network, and the latency is really, really good. So, you know, when I'm playing a game, I die. Martin sees that within about half a second. So it's a lot more... It feels a lot more like we're in the same room.
That's brilliant. You, how old were you when the ZX came out, the Speccy?
So I was born in 72. So
right.
My first computer was a ZX81 in 1980, Christmas 1980, I think.
Cool, you were lucky. 8 years old and you got a ZX80.
Sorry, ZX81, yeah.
Oh, 81.
I think it was 1980, I think so.
Yeah, that'd be about right, yeah.
My dad bought it for Christmas, and I remember on Christmas morning coming down the stairs, and I wasn't allowed in the front room, the lounge, where the telly was, and you couldn't see in there because the door didn't have glass in it. So we went into the kitchen and had breakfast, and the reason why we weren't allowed in the lounge is because my dad had plugged it into the telly, tuned the TV in, and then had typed in some code because he realized that, like, giving someone a ZX81 with no program loaded on it was pretty awful, pretty brutal way. Here's a computer and there's no software, right? So it's not like today where you could just, like,
hand you a little
apps.
Book with the, you know, start typing things in to get it working.
Yeah, off you go. That'll keep you busy over Christmas. Yeah. So, yeah, he typed it all in and I went in the lounge and that was it. That was the start of my computer.
So what was the first game? Was it Pong?
Oh, God, I can't even remember. It was probably something that was in either a Sinclair magazine. There was a magazine called Sinclair Programs, and it was mostly type-in listings. And I think it would have been something from that. If not, it might have been something from the manual. But I don't remember the ZX81 manual having games in it. I think it had like little sample code, but I don't think it had games in it. So probably from a magazine. I can't remember what it was. But it would have been something simple.
Yeah, when all that kicked off, I was in the middle of my first career as an engineer at sea, so I missed it. The computers hadn't come into schools when I left in 75. But I did get the first Sinclair Scientific calculator when I was at college.
Was that the white one or the silver one?
It was very small. I can't remember. And you had to do jiggery pokery to get it to work out sines, cosine. It wasn't just straightforward.
Yeah.
But it was amazing. All the other guys were buying Casios and stuff like that, but they were really expensive. And I bought this Sinclair one.
Yeah, my nan had one many years ago. She had both the. There was one called the Sinclair Scientific, I think, and I think that was white, and it kind of had a bulge in the back where the batteries were. And she also had a Sinclair Business one, which was silver and was a lot thinner because I think it took AAA batteries. But yeah, they were gorgeous little calculators. They really were.
They were, yeah. Yeah, I had lots of fun with that. One of our lecturers, he was an electrical engineer, and he used to teach us for electronics. And he could actually do things on the chalkboard, calculation wise, quicker than we could punch in the calculations into a calculator.
So I had a ZX81, and then I remember the Spectrum came out, and we didn't have a lot of money, so I didn't get a Spectrum. Until I saw a second-hand one in a record shop in Aldershot called Elephant Records. And it was a record shop my brother and sister used to go in because they used to buy a lot of records. And behind the counter, up on a high shelf, there was this second-hand Sinclair Spectrum. And I think my brother may have seen it, or I might have gone in with my brother and seen it in there and thought, oh, wow, there's a Spectrum for sale in here, second-hand, and it was 20 quid. And that would have been in 83, 84, something like that. And I begged and begged and begged my mum, you know, could I have this new computer, or secondhand new computer, and saved up the pennies and bought it. And it turned out to be a 16K Sinclair Spectrum, which, yeah, there were two models. The cheaper one was a 16K and the more expensive was a 48K. And the 16K one had room for you to expand to the 48K one, but obviously you'd have to buy an upgrade kit or send it off and get someone to upgrade it. And I was really, I was delighted to have this color computer, but then crestfallen that it was only a 16K one. I didn't realize at the time. And so the vast majority of games did not work because it didn't have enough RAM. And I remember buying some of the 16K games. There were some that were just brilliant, and I would still play. In fact, I have a couple of them on my desk right here. This is the sound of a cassette.
Yeah, great.
That is a 16K Spectrum game. And I remember buying Ant Attack, which is this cassette. And Ant Attack is a 48K game, and it was that drove me to save my pocket money and buy the upgrade kit to get it up to 48K. And there was an advert in one of the Sinclair magazines for a company called Video Vault, and they used to sell all kinds of accessories and bits and bobs that you could buy and add on to your Sinclair Spectrum. And one of them was this memory upgrade kit, and you had to send your Spectrum away. So I had to save up my money and send it away with a postal order for £35. And postal orders, eh? And
yeah,
got it back in the post. Really?
You can still go in the post office and get them.
Wow. And it came back in the post, and that was it. I had the Spectrum for a good few years after that. And yeah, so yeah, that was my first two computers.
If I remember correctly, the final Speccy came was 128k, wasn't it?
Yes, it was called a plus three.
Yeah. I didn't start getting interested in computers properly until I went back to college in 87, but I didn't get my own computer until 98 when I went to university for the first time.
The original Sinclair Spectrum had the horrible dead flesh rubber keyboard.
Yeah.
The plus two and the plus three. This is a plus three.
Oh, that's proper sound.
Proper keyboard. And the plus three had a disk drive, a 3-inch disk drive on the side. So,
wow.
I still have my plus three. It's right here next to me. And for my birthday a year ago, they were all getting a bit dusty and crusty in the loft, and I hadn't really taken care of them very well. And there's a guy who lives in Aberystwyth who repairs old 8-bit computers. Much like you repair cars, he repairs 8-bit computers. But he does it as a service. And I contacted him and said, look, I've got three Spectrums. I really need them, like, cleaning up and fixing. And he does, like, various electronics checks on them and replaces a few components that are dying. And so for my birthday, I asked my wife, could you please, you know, arrange for my Spectrums to be sent away and fixed. And so I sent away the plus three and my other two Spectrums. And he fixed them all up and sent them back. And they were cleaned up and they work perfectly. And there's changes they make to the video output. And I think they replace a couple of capacitors because they tend to go over time. But it's lovely. I'm really happy with my Spectrums.
What you want to do is try and pick up the ZX80 construction kit, because I remember that when they released it first, you could actually buy it and build it yourself.
Yeah, it was. It was a kit, wasn't it? It was a board and like half a dozen chips and not a lot more.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think somehow I got hold of a ZX80. I don't know how. I don't know if that was my dad's or something, but that was long given away to another friend. But yeah, I did. I do remember playing with a ZX80 and a ZX81, but I don't remember ever doing the soldering or anything.
Yeah, that would have been a bit much.
Go on. I was just going to wrap up the 8-bit versus thing. Me and Martin are now have the thing set up so that when we want to play a game, he launches OBS on his end, and on my end I've got whatever game I want to play and it streams to him, and then he sends it to Twitch and then people watch. And it's quite good fun because I've got old joysticks as well, so I've still got Kempston Competition Pro and a Konic Speed King and loads of old like equipment that was attached to my Spectrum, and I actually play some of these games using the original joysticks, which reminds me A, how terrible I am at these games, and B, how awful some of these joysticks were.
I've never got into computer gaming. It's one of those Same things here. That doesn't float me boat.
Yeah, it's weird. I have a friend who doesn't play computer games at all. And you know, doesn't see the point, and can't see why, you know, people spend so much time and money on computer games. It's funny how, you know, people have these vastly different interests.
Yeah, but computers have got lots of different uses. You know, I'll do video, audio. Well, not so much video, but audio editing, and I use GIMP and all that for doing photo stuff. You know, so there's lots of different things you can do on a computer, but games never struck me as something that I wanted to get involved in. Just like the Matchbox hobby, it'd probably take over my life if I did.
I think the thing, I guess, because I was at that age where a computer arrived on the scene when I was 9, 10 years old, something like that. And so at that time, I'm going to be playing, you know, games on it. And obviously stuff was well marketed. You go into Martin's, the newsagent, or WH Smith's or whatever newsagent, and they had a whole section of, you know, buying computer games. I remember those carousels where you'd have loads of tapes in it and you spin the carousel round looking for whatever the latest new game is or whatever's on in the bargain bucket of, you know, $1.99 games, save up my pocket money and spend £2 on a game. But that one game would last. Like the when you think of the value for money, spending £2 for a game, and once you loaded it, because you've made the commitment of like it's an investment. Like £2 is quite an investment for a child whose pocket money might have been only £1 or so a week if you're lucky. The investment of buying it, and then the time investment of loading it, because it took like 10 minutes to load off of a tape. You're committed then to playing that game. You're not going to just turn the computer off. It's not like when I see people playing games on phones and stuff, they'll load a game, play a game, and then get frustrated with it and then just close it and then load something else. And the fact that it's instant means they're not committed to that game. And I think that's partly what's led games to try and hook you in with notifications and try and on mobile devices and hook you in with, well, if you come back every day, we'll give you bonuses and all that kind of stuff that tries to entice you to come back. Whereas with the old 8-bit days, just the virtue of buying the game and loading the game was commitment enough, because like otherwise you've wasted £2 and you've wasted 10 minutes of your life loading the thing. You might as well play it for an hour or more. Yeah.
It sounds a bit like when I was a kid and we had a Scalextric set, and it used to take nearly an hour to get the track set up and get the transformer on and everything like that.
Clean the brushes.
So once you got it set up, you had to play for it for at least an hour to make it all worthwhile.
Yeah. Oh, I think I only had one Scalextric set. They were so great. I used to really love the tracks you could build with them, especially if you got loads of extra parts and loads of, you know, extra second-hand bits and pieces. I think we did get some second-hand bits and pieces that were from, like, a Scalextric from the 60s or something. And, like, they managed to fit together with the ones that we had from the 80s. They were amazing.
Yeah, Scalextric track was compatible right the way through. But we only had the Figure of Eight set up with the bridge going over the track to make the Figure of Eight. But the two cars that came with this set, my dad had bought it when he'd had a good working week one Christmas, and they had light-up headlights on the cars.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we had hours of fun with that. I wish I still had it. I sold it when I was in my 20s, and I should never have sold it.
The detail on those cars was great, though. Especially like the rally cars and the I think we had a John Player Special Formula One car, and my brother had a Ford Escort rally car, and he loved that car like more than playing with the Scalextric. Just like handling the car and like just looking at the car was almost as much fun as playing with it on the track.
Oh yeah, you still much like the Matchbox, you get people who collect the old slot cars, Scalextric and the other slot cars that were made, just for the actual models. So back to computing. What's your current Lenovo that you're using as your daily driver at the moment?
Yeah, I my current one is a T450, which is the one I'm sat at right now. And it's I bought it in 2016, I think. So the general rule of thumb is the middle digit, the 5 in a 450 means 2015. That's roughly the year it was made.
Oh, right.
So an X220 was made in 2012, roughly. Just gives you a benchmark for how old the machines are. So my T450 was made in 2015, and I think I got it in 2016. I got it secondhand because I couldn't really justify the price or afford a brand new ThinkPad. So I got it secondhand. And I've upgraded the RAM. It's now got 32 gigs of RAM in it, which I got on eBay. There were two separate sellers that had 16 gig DIMMs available on the same day from completely different people, but they were exactly the same model of DIMM. I was like, I must buy these two to get 32 gig.
Yeah.
And I've upgraded the SSD, and I've actually replaced the display panel because the panel was a reflective one, which was a bit rubbish. So I've replaced it with a matte display. And it sits in a docking station on my desk. And yeah, that's my main machine.
Brilliant. Just recently, I've moved over to Dell's. I've got a Dell 744. Well, I've got a couple of them. I've got an i5 and an i7. And they're cracking looking machines. But I've still got my X230i. And I've got a X201 knocking about. And I've got the X200 tablet as well.
The 7440, has that got the nipple in the middle of the keyboard?
I haven't got it in front of me. I think it might actually, yeah.
Yeah, that's one of the killer features that I love about the ThinkPads is having the nipple. I always turn off the trackpad completely, so my trackpad doesn't actually function at all. I only use the nipple. And I know people are like passionate hatred of one and like passionate love of the other or whatever. But yeah, those Dells look really nice.
They are cracking little machines. I've also got a couple of Toshiba Z30s. They're nice. The screen's a bit small on them because it's only 13 inch, but they're really lightweight, so they're very portable as well.
I had a bad experience with the Toshiba once, and I mean, I used to love the stuff they made back in 93, 94, 95, that kind of era. The 1910 CS, a big white chunky thing that had a trackball mouse that clipped on the right hand side of the laptop, was just delightful. It was felt nice and robust. And the follow up, I think, was a 2100 CS, which was a kind of dark grey colour. And that, I think, was my first laptop that had a nipple. And it was on the Toshiba, it came with a green nipple and two curved mouse buttons, which were a bit weird. I used to love those. But I had a bad experience with a Toshiba some years later, and that really turned me off from buying Toshibas.
Oh, that's a shame. Back in around about 2011, 2012, I managed to get a couple of R500s, which were ultrabooks in the day. And I remember taking them around to various Linux events and using them for demoing Linux, and they were brilliant little machines.
I don't think I've seen an R500.
Yeah, it was a little silver ultrabook. It was a Core 2 series, I think. They weren't very upgradable. The RAM on them was a little strange. It was custom RAM, I think. Not on that one. It was an earlier one that I had that was custom RAM. But they were nice little machines. The only problem was the screen was a little bit thin, and it was easy to damage if you weren't careful because it was fairly flexible. But yeah, I ended up giving Josh one of them.
It's relatively modern, really, that R500. In fact, it's got a Windows key. I mean, relatively, you know, it's got a Windows key on it.
Are you looking at it online now?
Yeah, every laptop you're mentioning, I'm Googling to get a picture of, so I can see what you're talking about.
Oh dear, that's a great thing now. You can just go online and search things up as you're talking.
Yeah, those Dell 7440s look quite robust. They've got connectors up the wazoo as well.
Yeah, it's got pretty well everything you need on it. USB 3, HDMI, all works. I've also got its smaller brother, the 7250. 12-inch one.
Nice. Yeah, I can't justify buying any more laptops. I have to curb my enthusiasm slightly.
I've lost my source of cheap computers since the auction shut down. Used to have a local auction about 40 miles away from me in Bolton. And once a month they used to have a sale that you could go to, and they'd be selling old corporate stuff.
Did it actually work out cheap?
Oh, you could get some really good deals. Because they were authorised refurbishers, what they used to do was wipe everything, make sure everything worked. So when you got it, there was no operating system on it, although quite often it would have a Windows license key on it. And towards the end, they were selling stuff with Windows 8. licenses, so you could just reinstall Windows 8 out of the box because that would reactivate anyway.
Neat.
But yeah, I picked up some of those Z30s for like 50, 60 quid.
Very nice.
But it's all gone because the couple that ran it have retired.
How dare they?
I know, it's bad. I can't get my computer fixed anymore once a month.
Yeah, I wish there were, I don't know, I'm now Googling for auctions in my local area. Which is a terrible thing to do because I'll end up coming back with, I'm trying to limit because I've got, I don't know, 13 ThinkPads or something like that, which I think is probably enough. But then I see a nice example of an X230 or something, and I think, oh, I've got a 220, but a 230 is just a little bit better, and maybe I want that.
Yeah, the only problem, you go on eBay to look for these things, and people are asking ridiculous money for them. So yeah. Unless you can find a really good auction that no one's following and get something cheap, which I did with one of those Dell 7440s, actually, the i7 one. It was actually advertised as an i5, and when it came, it was an i7. So I was quite chuffed about that.
Nice. One of the problems I have with my X220 and with the ThinkPads actually is their thermal design is not great, and they are incapable of dumping the heat that they generate particularly well. So my X220 is an i7 and it overheats all the time, and I've done all the usual stuff. I mean, it overheated from day one, so it wasn't like the thermal paste was duff. It was just the design of it. It just didn't have a beefy enough fan or the beefy enough heatsink or vents the right size or whatever, I don't know, but it just couldn't dump the heat that it needed to.
Yeah, I've noticed that the fans running on the those Lenovos all the time, really.
One place I've noticed people selling laptops these days actually is actually on Facebook Marketplace, which often turns up the odd bargain, which if it was sold on eBay would generate a slightly higher price. So I mean, there's right now I'm looking at an X230 on Facebook, and it's 100 quid, which is a reasonable price for a SSD decent life battery i5 with 4 gig of RAM.
But yeah, that's pretty good.
It would be nice to get one a bit cheaper than that.
Yeah, we're always looking for cheaper.
Yeah.
I'll have to check out Marketplace.
Hi, everybody. Can you hear me?
Hello.
We can.
That's good. That's good. Dave Morris here, as you probably gathered, or maybe gathered, I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Your voice is very distinctive, Dave. I can always recognise that.
I was told I sound like Mr. Chumley Warner by somebody, and he speeds up his podcast. Sound just like Mr. Chumley Warner. And so I'm not sure if that's a compliment or not, and most of the Americans won't get that as well.
I understood that reference.
So Ken
was selling you short. He said you've got a life.
I have actually been listening. But no, I don't have a life. Good grief! No, I heard that. I thought he's winding me up, isn't he? He wants to join in. That's what that's all about. So, yeah, I was interested in your talking about Lenovo's and stuff because my kids both have acquired them off eBay in the past year, and my son's girlfriend as well. So when they're visiting, there's a row of these damn things, and I'm thinking, oh, I could do with one of those. The entryware that I won at Alcab a few years ago is lovely, but it's big. I'd like something a bit smaller that I could trot to conferences with.
Yeah, those X series ones. I think all the way through from like the X220, 230, skip the 240, maybe 260, 270, 280. They're lovely. Even the 220 now is still a very usable machine, and those are 10 a penny. They're all over the internet because they were a super popular corporate laptop, so there's tons of them around. It's old and, you know, crusty, and it's first generation i7, and or i5, but it's still a lovely little machine.
Yeah, yeah, that would suit me just fine, just to run a minimal Linux of some sort and, you know, just use it for nothing very heavyweight, but just general odds and sods that you might want to do at a conference or whatever.
I don't even think you need to go minimal on it. I've got elementary on mine, and I've installed, I use it as my test machine when I'm doing like QA testing for ISO images, and I've installed all manner of stuff on it, and it's perfectly usable with full fat Linux distros too.
That's really good to know. Yeah. All the ones that sit in this house are all running Windows, but they seem to get on pretty well with that. So Windows 10.
I think anything that runs, first or second gen Core i can run most things that's Linux these days, can't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a RAM still
killer. If you get one that's only got like 2 gig of RAM, then it gets a little bit painful. But most of the corporate ones will have i5 and 4 gig of RAM. The weird thing is with the X220 is that i5s only have USB 2 and the i7 has one USB port, but it's not labeled and it's not colored. So you'd be forgiven for thinking it's USB 2 everywhere, but it's got one USB 3 port, but only on the i7 models.
Yeah, but they've got a little card bay that you can stick a USB 3 card in it, can't you?
Oh, like a, what's it called? Card bus or something?
Yeah, I can't remember the name of it, but I know I've done it on one of my early Lenovos that didn't have USB 3.
Huh, I've never tried using one of those cards. I mean, I remember PCMCIA cards from back in the past, but I've not tried a card bus card.
Yeah, it's Express Card, I think you call it.
That's it, Express Card.
Okay. I was impressed by the fact that the one my daughter got had had two batteries in it, and the fixed one was faulty. She got a replacement for it, and she brought it over here one day and said, "Dad, can I borrow your screwdrivers? Because I think they're Torx." And within about 10 minutes, she'd stripped it down and put the new battery in, you know. So
nice.
So, so it's really, really nice to work with, which is a big selling point, I would have thought.
You've taught her properly.
Yeah. It's reached the point where she teaches me, mind you, but yes.
Yeah. The only downside to the early Core i series is probably battery life. If you've got a fourth or fifth generation, battery life's going to be a bit better.
Yeah. Okay. That's good. I shall go hunting when I get a moment, I think. So, go on.
No, go on, Dave.
No, I was just going to say, I have used Christmas to do a really loony project, and I was just going to share it with you. I got more Raspberry Pis here than I really should have, because a lot of them are not doing anything. And I've got one of the 3A pluses, which is small but moderately powerful, and I'm thinking I've really got to use it for something. So I've been trying to – I wanted a project where I've got an old monitor, an old Dell monitor from a family computer back in 2005 probably, a square, strange-looking thing. But it still works, VGA only. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if I can make it a, some sort of a status display. So I've been searching, because I use MQTT around the house for all sorts of things at the moment. No Internet of Things stuff, but just telling one computer about another one and all that sort of business. So just trying to find some way of making it into a running status display with a clock and that sort of stuff. And I found a project called Magic Mirror. People are putting stripped down monitors behind mirrors. So
yeah, I've seen that.
Have you seen those? Yeah.
Yeah. So, if you go to the archive for Magpie magazine, there's a write up on it in there about one of them.
Yeah, I found that there's a group that had built something in Node.js, which is a language I don't know, but and they had made it into a really nice modular thing. So you can just install it without any fuss at all. And there's loads and loads and loads of modules you can stick within it to make it do all manner of things. So I've been having a wonderful time playing with the, I wonder what this module does. Click, ooh, it displays the news from the BBC and, you know, all that sort of stuff. I don't really know why I want to have news headlines popping up on a monitor on this shelf up here, but you know, it's amusing.
Yeah, but you're not doing it for the news headlines. You're doing it to play and see if you can get it to work.
That's right. Yeah. There's a big element of play in there.
I've often seen these things where people like hack together a magic mirror for, you know, for like, I made a magic mirror for my girlfriend or whatever out of a Raspberry Pi, and they, you know, hot snot all this inside an
IKEA frame or something like that.
Yeah, like a frame.
With a one-way mirror on the front.
Yeah, and it looks cool. And then I think, but I'm not sure I really want to leave a, like, 14, 18-inch panel constantly on. Like, because nobody's ever looking at it. Like, the amount of time I spend looking in a mirror in a day is a vanishingly small quantity of my life.
Yeah, I quite agree with that, yes. Mine's not a mirror at all, it's just a monitor, so I'm not bothering with all that stuff. It's a monitor on it. I'll probably put it on, you know, one of these Visa mounts that, you know, right. an arm so I can swivel it around and stuff. But at the moment, it's just a little monitor stood on its original stand. Up on the shelf above my my main desktop machine.
That so makes it's sense.
Yeah that and I just discovered an MQTT interface, so you can send it messages and, you know, you can, I want to work out how I can classify the messages, have urgent things saying, I don't know, there's somebody at the front door, perhaps. I'm getting deaf in my old age, so something that tells me the postman's trying to get in touch with you.
Yeah, you'll have to talk to the chief, because he created a little Raspberry Pi with a screen, one of the Raspberry Pi screens, I think it was the 4-inch one, and made a Harry Potter themed thing that came up with Sirius Black on it, just saying something. I think it was about a 30-second clip, and it was for his girlfriend's his partner's birthday.
Yeah, it sounds good. There's so many wonderful projects out there when you start looking. You just sort of have a question in mind and you go looking. And loads of people have done it, and it's all free and, you know, and easily stuck together. You don't need to be a coder at all these days, unless you're the guy creating it. But the users don't have to be coders.
No, because even creating it, a lot of this is freely available on the web anyway. You just have to actually put the code in and just copy what someone else has done.
Yep, that's exactly what I'm doing.
So did you hear the conversation earlier before we got onto Lenovo's about Matchbox cards?
Yeah, I remember we met up at Old Campus, I'm sure you remember, but just for the context, and you were mentioning that then.
Yeah.
Is that going well?
Yeah, well, at the time during Old Camp, I'd just started getting into it. I bought a couple of models to actually send to one of the YouTube guys that had kind of got me into it. But since then, it's kind of gone off the scale, so to speak.
Are you sitting in some darkened room with a magnifying glass fixed to your head somehow and staring at these things with a powerful light and stripping them down and painting them and all this sort of stuff? Is that the right image that I should be visualizing here?
Well, the darkened room, not so much. I've got a very nice double front of house double bedroom that is now my workshop, and it's got all my computer gear, the audio set up for podcasting and all my model making.
Excellent. So you can always retire to that when you need to.
I do.
Very good. Yeah. Well, I'm hoping there'll be we can't call on you to do HBR episodes on this necessarily, can we? But I think we should. I think we should.
Ken says yes.
Yes.
He told us off earlier on for the conversation we were having. He said, that should be a show.
Absolutely. No, I would love to see some of these things. Yeah, it sounds really good.
Yeah. You,
mm-hmm, go on.
You could put pictures in the show notes to show people what you've been doing as well.
Well, that's what I was thinking. You know, some good close-up photos of some sort would be lovely. See that sort of stuff.
So you're about my age, aren't you? Do you remember the Matchbox and Corgi stuff from the late 50s, early 60s?
I might be a little bit beyond your age, actually. I just turned 70 this month.
I didn't realise you were quite that old.
I don't look it, do I? I look amazingly
young. You don't sound
young,
it either. You don't
young
sound
and spry
70.
Is me. Yeah, no, it happens. You just sort of sit around and them years just keep clicking by.
I know. I've just turned 61.
Ooh, right, yes. Oh, I remember the Matchbox very well. I think I said to you, I had a lot of dinky toys when I was a kid. That would have been in the 1950s, so sort of post-war stuff. But they were starting to become available. You just got the one for Christmas, you know, and that would last you a year.
Yeah, because they were expensive.
They were. They lasted amazingly well.
Even the Matchbox ones, I was saying to Alan, I couldn't afford them when I was a kid because they were just, even though they were only a couple of shillings each in the mid-60s, that was still way above what I was getting for pocket money. So I maybe had one or two for presents, but that was about it.
Yeah. The thing about the dinky ones was that they had quite a lot of moving parts on them. So there was like a loader lorry type of thing with a little crank handle on the side, and you turned it, and a spiral rod in the center lifted the back up, so you could actually put sand in it and tip it out. So that's just wonderful for kids. I don't remember, did Matchbox have that sort of feature?
Some of the Super King stuff does, but the actual small Matchbox size ones, no, they may have opening boots and opening doors, but that's about it.
Yeah, I remember being very impressed when doors and boots and things opened. I think the dinkies are a little bit bigger, and they tended to have a bit more moving parts, like the sort of bin lorry thing had sliding sides to it from the old days when they used to tip metal dustbins into the side of these things as they chug down the road. None of this fancy stuff with lifters at the back and things.
Yeah, there are a few smaller models that do have tipping backs and things for the construction ones, and you've got the crane models where the crane moves and things like that.
But very
simple stuff.
Yeah. No, it's good, but a child's imagination will get way past that anyway. If you do have moving bits, well, that's good. But if you don't, then you can, you know, pretend that they do and make them fly or whatever else you wanted to entertain yourself.
Yeah, when you buy them off eBay as a job lot, spares or repair, you can tell the ones that have been played in the sandpit with because they're still full of dirt.
Yes. And smashed together a bit.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. That's good stuff.
Yeah, I was just thinking Corgi and Dinky were the expensive load. But I remember I think it was Corgi did the James Bond, what do you call it, DB5? With the roof that opened and flipped out the little plastic man the guns at the front and all that. That was really complex, but that was way outside our price range.
That would have cost a few quid, I bet. Yeah. good stuff. I still got my dinky toys and wonder what I should be doing with them, really, because all the tyres have all perished and fallen off in many cases. Presumably,
well, you can get replacements.
I could be following your lead here and repairing them, perhaps.
Yeah, you can go online, and there's plenty of places where you can buy spares for dinky, and the rubber tires are one of the things that goes for, you know, because like you say, they perish with age. You quite often you'll see models where the tire has got a flat spot on it, and it's been sat on a windowsill and got hot, and the car's just sunk because the tire's started to melt a bit.
I bet. See, that vintage tended not to have windows and stuff, did it? None of the ones I've got windows in them, because later on there were plastic windows, but plastic wasn't that
common.
By the 60s,
they were starting to have windows in them, but even the Matchbox 50s models, a lot of them didn't have windows in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because plastic was mainly Bakelite in the 50s, wasn't it? It wasn't a lot of the sort of plastics you see these days.
No, but by the end of the 50s, it was starting to come in, and they did start putting screens in some of the very late 1950s models, but that became quite common in the 60s.
Yeah, cool. There's a lot to say about this stuff, actually. So yeah,
there is, isn't there?
There's a whole series of HBR shows, you see, you know, Tony.
the problem with this is it's so visual, and that's why the YouTubers do so well with it.
No, understood. But just sharing some of your enthusiasm would be fun. But I'll stop trying to force you into doing shows any minute now.
No, I had thought about it.
That's cool. What other makes would you been working with, did you say?
I haven't actually done any restos. Because I've been picking up a lot of job lots for spares and repairs, you quite often get Corgi and Dinky and stuff included.
Okay.
And there was Corgi had another line that they produced for Woolworths called Huskies, and they were the small matchbox size models. And in 1969, Woolworths stopped selling them, so they turned that line into Corgi Juniors. So they were producing matchbox sized cars even in the 60s, mm-hmm. but they just mm-hmm. weren't labelled as Corgi up until 69.
Okay, yeah, so that passed me by, I'm afraid.
Yeah, you get them. They do actually tend to have plastic bases, believe it or not. They were definitely using plastic quite a bit in there. I think it was because they were for Woolworths and they were trying to produce them as cheap as possible.
Yeah. Oh, cool. So, yeah, so you will be starting to do restorations at some point then?
Oh, I've already done my first couple.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I restored a little Mark 10 Jaguar, the Matchbox one, and that came out quite nicely, actually.
I heard you say you were using caustic soda to take old paint off. Okay. So that gets you down to, is it like alloy or something underneath?
Yeah, they used a specific alloy for the castings. I think it's called zircon or something. You've got to be careful with it because it's delicate. Yeah, when you strip the paint off, Matchbox, unlike some of the other premium brands, they didn't undercoat their models when they were spraying them. They just sprayed them straight on with the top colour. So they should, unless it's been overpainted by some child in the past, there should only be one layer of paint, really.
Right.
And it generally comes off quite easily. You just got to be very careful because caustic soda is a bit of a dangerous chemical if you're not using it properly.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you don't want it on your skin in any form or in your eyes. You need to wear good protection. You probably ought to have a face mask as well because you'll breathe some of the vapor in, won't you?
I tend to use quite a large jar and then stick the top on it. You just got to be careful that you release the pressure because obviously it's generating gas while it's working. You just make sure that you don't leave it dead tight on it.
Yes, it'll react quite violently, I would imagine, at some point.
It does if you use very hot water. you can use it with just tap hot water, but it takes a bit longer to do the job. But that's better if you're using it to take off the paint off plastics, because you don't want the plastics to melt and distort.
No. So yeah, the hot, you don't want too much heat there. But the caustic soda doesn't affect these alloys, does it?
Aluminium, it totally eats away. You've got to be very careful with aluminium, and they did make metal wheels for some of the models that are aluminium, so you don't want to be putting them in. Sometimes they get, but there are other ways of removing paint from some of the more delicate parts. One of the ways is using Dettol. That works. And another way is to use brake fluid. Brake fluid dissolves gradually.
Yeah. Because you should be careful not to get it on your paintwork if you're ever doing your brakes, should you?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
it does, it destroys stuff. Your paintwork.
But things like alcohol and stuff won't take any of that off.
No.
Acetone, nothing like that.
You've got to be very careful with things like acetone. You can use it. You can use it. You've got to be very gentle with it. Some people use it for the modern cars, for the modern Hot Wheels, for taking off the decals, for cleaning them up if they're doing custom jobs and they've got a modern casting that's got loads of decals on it. They'll use acetone for taking off the decals before they carry on and do if they don't want to completely paint strip it, they just want to get rid of it.
Oh, I'm with you. Yeah. So you can just use a light amount of it just
very carefully
detach those from the thing. Yeah, that's cool.
So that's quite good. But there's so much once you get into it, and then of course you can create your own decals, or you can buy replacement decals for the models as well.
That sends me back to
sometimes you can pay more for a set of decals for a model than you paid for the model originally.
Wow, it's ridiculous, isn't it? Yeah, I know. The prices of things is nuts. That puts me in mind of doing Airfix stuff, where those little teeny tiny things you had to stick on them when they were built. That, presumably that sort of stuff is sort of film with an adhesive backing or something, is it?
Well, the water decals, they come on a sheet, and you cut it out. You stick them in you cut them out to shape, and then you stick them in water, and then the actual decal floats off, and then you apply it to the model. There's two types. There's one with a white backing, so you don't want to be using them on something that's dark. But if you're using it on a white background, that's fine. Or these clear backed decals. But if you've got white lettering that you want to apply onto a dark surface, you've got to get a specialist decal producer, because white toners are particularly specialised printing medium.
All right. Okay. Gosh, yes. There's a lot to investigate there, I can see.
There is. But there's some great YouTube videos out there. I follow quite a few and watch their videos, so you get lots of tips on what to do and how to do stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Very good. Certainly keeps you busy.
It does. So are you doing anything special for Hogmanay tonight?
Nah, we don't really celebrate it much in this family. It's just keep your head down. No, I live on the outskirts of Edinburgh, so it's pretty quiet. There'll be lots of fireworks and stuff as the night goes on, but not a lot. In the centre of Edinburgh, it will be completely insane. But
oh yeah, because they have the big firework display in the centre of Edinburgh, don't they?
I've always avoided it. In the 30-plus years I've lived here, I've never gone and joined in. It's just too many people for me.
Yeah. I was watching the news last night because Sydney have a big firework display every year, and there's been a lot of people calling for them to cancel it because all around Sydney's where all the bushfires are at the moment.
Yeah, it looks appalling, doesn't it? Absolutely dreadful.
A lot of the smaller towns around the Sydney suburbs, they've cancelled their firework displays, but Sydney have said, well, we've already paid for it. It was paid for months ago, and we're just going to go ahead.
Just add to the smoke a bit.
Yeah, that's what a lot of, there's been nearly 500,000 people have signed a petition telling them to cancel it.
Yes, I wouldn't want to be in Australia right now, I have to say. It looks pretty dire over that side of things.
Yeah, that first YouTuber I started following, Marty, he lives in Australia.
Yeah, I visited Australia about, I don't know, nearly 30 years ago. Around that area, Sydney and a bit, is it south from there? Bateman's Bay, that area. And thought, wow, this is nice. I wouldn't mind living here. But yeah, but then climate change happened. Not sure live anywhere. Scotland seems reasonable for the moment. It's still cold enough.
Yeah, it was a bit chilly here in Blackpool today. I went out to go to the gym and my car was iced up.
Yeah, yeah, it's like that. It's been like that here. It's been minus one. Just looking at my little display here, it's 2.7 degrees at the moment, but it was minus one earlier on, which is not amazingly cold, but it's chilly.
Yeah. So no snow around.
Nah, nothing much. My daughter went up to. So about a week or so ago, she went north. There's a zoo, Highland Zoo, which is an offshoot of Edinburgh Zoo. She went up there to visit, and it was very snowy. Not precisely sure where it is, but it's up in the Highlands. So yeah, that was just about a week ago. So but it didn't last a huge lot of time, but you'd expect to get snow in the Highlands.
Yeah, I remember a few years ago going up to Cathcart to see my in-laws, and it was snowing that time, and remember creeping round the small side streets because they were chock full of snow.
Oh, yeah. The snow itself is not too bad for getting around, but when it freezes is the worst.
You know, yeah, that was the main problem.
Yeah, semi-thaw and then freeze, and that's hell, both on foot and in a car and everything.
Yeah, it was pretty bad that year, but I don't know how long it lasted, because we were only up for a couple of days.
We don't get a lot of snow in Edinburgh. I think we had some, when was it now, about 6 or 7 years ago, there was very, very heavy snow, to the point where the council was bringing in large wagons to shovel the snow off the streets into them and then take them away and dump them somewhere, which is a pretty rare thing to see. But we've not seen that sort of thing for a long time since that.
That was probably round about the time we were up in Glasgow. So, yeah, probably the same time there when they had that heavy snow.
Yeah. It's a pretty nasty. It was, you know, it was quite a lot of it. There was a lot of shoveling required to get out of the driveway in my house.
Hello to the newcomer.
Seems
to be muted.
He's muted, yeah.
How would you pronounce that? Urugami?
Urugami. I think we've heard Urugami on Hacker Public Radio perhaps, or on some other podcast. I don't know. Tell us.
I can hear the mic blowing, but I can't hear you. Urugami.
Urugami is correct. Thank you.
Ah, we got you. Hello. Happy New Year or Happy New Year's Eve, whatever.
Yes. Hello. I'm going back quiet.
So have you got any projects particular into the new year, Tony?
Well, continuing with the two podcasts, Mintcast and Distro Helpers, obviously the models.
But the podcasts take a fair bit of your time, I would imagine. Are you doing a lot of research for them?
Not so much research, but I share the audio editing for Mintcast with Leo, who's our lead host, and I also do all the post-production for the Distro Helpers one.
Okay, yeah. So that can be quite a process. Take a fair bit of time.
Yeah, DistroHoppers isn't too bad because it's just the two of us. So the audio editing itself is fairly straightforward. You just got great, and we only record for about 45-50 minutes. So you just got to slowly work your way through it. But it took me a while to work out how to do all the posting to Blogger and all that to get the feed to work, but now I'm into it. It's not too bad.
Yeah. Oh, good. Yeah. These services can be a bit of a problem, but it took me a long time to get to the point where I could reliably post HBR stuff to archive.org, because putting the audio there is not a big problem, but I wanted to make sure that the shows were completely self-contained. You know, contained any supplementary stuff, all the notes, any pictures and that sort of stuff. And I think it's taken me years to perfect that, to be honest with you.
It took me a couple of months to work out how to embed the logo so that when you push the feed to a podcatcher, it shows the little logo in your podcatcher alongside that particular stream. But I finally worked out you had to actually post the image that you wanted to appear alongside your stream on your podcatcher, and then put a link in with in your blog thing for that as well, and then that works. But yeah, that took a bit of figuring out.
yeah, there's a lot to learn. Still, that's quite fun. That sounds like fun. Still plenty of podcasts going. Podcasts have increased in popularity in the past year or more, seems, although the fact that quite a number of them don't use RSS or Atom bothers me slightly. But you know, they're all going to the various platforms whose names I can't remember, but things that you need to be using specifically. You can't just use a generic podcatcher to grab stuff.
Oh, right. Most of the ones I listen to are all RSS or Atom because they just push straight to me podcatcher.
Yeah, me too. But you do, like, for example, I saw an advert for Bill Nye's latest thing. I've never really listened to him. I thought, well, it'd be interesting to hear his podcast. No way could I subscribe to it because it was Apple and it was Stitcher maybe or those types of things, and they're not very Linux friendly, these things.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So that's an ongoing trend, that's a bit of a shame, I think. But maybe it's not. Maybe there's just a few.
That was the other problem we had. I can't get DistroHoppers into the Apple podcatcher thing, because you've got to have spent money in an Apple account before you can post stuff to the podcast system.
Yeah. That's the sort of thing, is people trying to tie some sort of so-called monetization with these things. Just wonder if it bothers me slightly that it might be hijacked in some way, but hopefully not.
Yeah, theoretically you can create an Apple account without actually spending money, but in practice you can't.
Yes, sounds like a very political way to deal with things. So I, talking about projects again, my neighbour just had an extension built. And yeah, great. You know, people build extensions to houses these days as a wood-framed thing with, and then this guy's put a brick skin on it. And he had a lot of leftover joists and other such bits of wood. And I said, and he was, the builder was starting to load them in a skip to throw away. And I said, do you want them? Can I have them? So I've got a garage full of joists and bits like that, quite long, some of them, almost too long for the garage. So my project, as soon as the weather's up to it, it probably would have been today actually, is to make myself a good workbench with them, you know, do some nice woodworking and some good lap joints and that sort of stuff, and make a reasonably good solid workbench.
I've just inherited some antique woodworking equipment from my father-in-law, who passed away just before Christmas.
Oh, sorry to hear that. But yeah, oh, well, what sort of stuff have you got? Sort of old brace and bits and planes and things like that?
Yeah, there's a brace and bits, there's a plane, there's a square, there's various bits and pieces. I haven't fully sorted through it. The set squares, or the squares, got a bit of rust on me, but that'll clean up well.
But I
can see a plane at the bottom of the box, which I haven't got out yet. But it was amazing. I was really surprised.
That's lovely. Yeah.
When they were clearing out the house, my brother-in-law said, "Oh, there's a load of tools in Michael's garage. Does anyone want them before they get slung?" I said, "Oh, I'll have them. I'll have a sort through them, and if there's anything I can't use, I'll pass on to someone who can." And so we just before Christmas Eve, actually, we dropped into them to take their Christmas presents, and there was a big plastic, one of these big plastic storage boxes full of tools
that we loaded into the car. Fantastic. So,
yeah.
There's some HBR show potential there. Oh, fell into HBR mode there for a second.
You and Ken are always looking for new content.
That's what we do. But that's a really interesting thing. I have also inherited such stuff. My neighbour left a few years ago now, really quite friendly. And the husband was a carpenter for a lot of, until he got old and retired and stuff. And they were clearing stuff out, and it's the same sort of scenario, a box, you know, a handmade box of tools, many of them as rusty as could be because they'd been sat in a garage for a number of years. And they said, do you want them? So I said, yes, please. And it's planes and chisels and gouges and all sorts of really cool stuff. So the plan is to get them de-rusted and back into use again. There's some of these really big, long smoothing planes, and the ones that you can make, what do you call it? The ones have got shaped blade to them, so you can make, the word has escaped me, but the sort of decorative wood edgings on things.
So kind of little hand routers kind of
thing.
Yeah,
yeah, that type of thing, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, these things fascinate me. I'm not much of a woodworker, but I did learn it at school, and I've always been quite fascinated with making things out of wood.
Yeah, I'm looking at a tin now. It's a very un-PC tin. It's a very old cigarette tin, Mitchell's Prize Crop cigarettes, but it's full of woodworking bits for the hand drill, and there's a little tool for... what do you call it? For creating circles on metal. So it's a nice. Protractor. For making for scoring circles on sheet metal and things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. That would be good. Good.
And it's got the old little curved bar, so that one end of it can slide up, and the little flat-ended screw that holds it tight when you've got it into the size you want. It's really cool.
Oh, yes. They don't make them like that anymore.
No.
I do know what you mean, though. Those are lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, yeah, it's we must compare notes at some point and do a series on woodworking tools of yesteryear or something.
That would be a good one, actually.
Yeah, I'm sure there's probably some quite knowledgeable people out there who do woodworking professionally, but still, it would be quite interesting subject to get onto. One of the downsides of living in the UK is that the quality of wood tends to be a lot lower than you'd find in some other parts. I think certainly. Watching woodworkers in America, the availability of really nice woods is very, very much easier than it is here. You can get quality stuff, but it's rare and it's massively expensive. And you have to go somewhere very specialized to get it.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But as far as the tools go, there's some of the really crafty woodworkers do want the antique tools, because especially if they're restoring old stuff, they want to be able to use the tools that would have made it in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. The unfortunately, if you go and buy the equivalent now, like I bought myself a Stanley, just the sort of standard plane, I can't remember what number it is, but the one that everybody recommends that you have in your toolkit if you're doing a bit of woodworking, just to do sort of simple planing, not to flatten great big lumps of wood or anything. So I bought one of those, and maybe in the 1970s I bought one, and it was a bit It was a little bit pricey. You go and try and find something of an equivalent quality now. They're all rubbish.
Yeah. Yeah, no weight to them at all.
No, no, no. And, you know, they're not as precise. They're made of poorer materials. They're just bad. You know, it's quite sad.
Yeah, they don't make it like they used to anymore.
Do you know, we sound like a couple of old geezers.
Yeah, grumpy old men.
Yeah, yeah. There's a point at which my kids are normally turning off. My kids would have turned off ages ago if they were listening to this. Oh,
the one thing they do make better than they used to, and that's cars.
Yeah, true.
Back in the 70s and 80s, cars used to fall apart after 6 years. Nowadays, my wife's driving a car that I bought from brand new, and it's 15 years old this year.
That is very true. I can remember my dad having a second-hand car, and you know, you needed to put under seal into the wings. Otherwise, you'd go and poke it and the thing would just be a sheet of rust.
Yes, I had one like that.
Like Vauxhalls that were particularly famous. The salty mud from the roads would go up into the wing. And within, by the summer, it was just like a sieve. You could literally poke your finger through it.
I had one of my first car I inherited off my mother, and it was a Datsun 120i Estate, and it wasn't that old, but a couple of years after I got it, it literally failed its MOT because it was totally full of rust, and it would have cost me more than I paid for the car to get it fixed up to get it through its MOT.
Oh yeah. I as a summer job, I used to work for my uncle who had a bodywork shop in Norwich, where I used to live, and that was the majority of the work that he did. You know, somebody bring a car in and say, I think there's a bit of rust here, and he'd spend ages taking the paint off, cutting the rust away, then making an aluminium plate that went over the space where the rust was, and then using filler and sanding it in so it became invisible, and then respraying it, you know. And that, and it probably next year it rusted in somewhere else.
Yeah.
The wing had fallen off. Or,
yeah, the repair was stronger than the rest of the car.
Yeah. Absolutely. Nobody ever said, why did they make them so badly? But they did. And it made him a living anyway.
Yeah. Right, I'm going to have to go and have a walk round. I've been sat at this in this computer chair for an hour and a half, and my back's going.
I was thinking about the same thing. Yeah, I haven't had any lunch yet, so I'm going to go and get something to eat. So
I'll go and make myself a coffee and have 20 minutes walking around, and I'll come back. I'll
maybe speak to you later then, Tony.
All right, cheers, Dave.
All right, cheers. Ta-da. See you, lads.
Cheers, Ken.
And I'll stop the recording from now, and I'll start another one, and hope that it records. Yep, cool.
Greetings, everybody. I haven't tested any of this audio stuff here, and this device has fallen onto concrete many times. Just jumping on here, say, Happy New Year. Just woke myself up, got me a fresh cup of coffee. And I'm going to get myself ready for the day. So I think if anybody's actually here, maybe I'll hear something. So I hope we get some activity. Looks like we got a few folks that are in here. But once again, I don't even know if this thing's working. So we'll see.
We hear you, Brian.
Talk to you later. Can you hear us?
Nope, am I muted? Why can't you hear us?
Huh. I thought I heard something there for a second. Maybe not. Oh, there's Ken. Hi, Ken.
Happy New Year. Hi, Brian. Happy New Year.
Glad to see you're on. I got an email saying you wouldn't be here, but I guess you are.
I don't think your audio is working, Brian.
Oh, that sucks. Well, I guess if my audio doesn't work, or if I'm not hearing, then fuck. Okay. Maybe I'll figure this out one day. All right. I did get Ken there for a second, but I think I've got this configured wrong. So, we'll see. Let me get myself woken up, and we'll figure this out. Greetings, everybody. I sure hope this works a little better. Just made my way into work, and it seems like everyone else is sleeping in today. So I'm just going to be sitting here for a few minutes, waiting on them. Ah, here comes somebody. Well, not the somebody with keys, but somebody anyway. And well, let's see, what's it look like we got to do here today? Pretty sure we got these vent window assemblies for this 57 Chevy hardtop. That's a pretty neat job. These owners just want everything done. Every time we get it done, we say it's all done. And then they say, okay, well, how about this little dinky thing? So they're going to have a fully restored 1957 Chevy hardtop here pretty soon. Not till next year, though. We got a 75 Stingray, old Corvette, having a e-brake issue, which really is annoying because you have to disassemble the entire rear hub to get to the e-brake. You can't even fit anything in there. What else? I think we got ball joints. That's what I'm going to do first thing, I think. I see this thing in here, an old Chevy Silverado. Need some ball joints. That'll be fun. They're not too bad. And then, of course, there's another one, a 93 Silverado that needs a door lock mechanism. Hopefully, I do the door lock. Nah, I do the ball joints, then I do the door lock. Start on the vent windows, and we'll cut out of here by lunchtime. But that's pretty wishful thinking. I don't even know if this is working, so might just be talking to myself.
Well, I can definitely say you're not talking to yourself, and it is working.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you.
Sounds like you have a fun day ahead of you.
Yeah, it won't be too bad. Except we lost someone this week. They decided that they need to be 3 hours away. So we'll find out. They come back next week, they might have a job.
Yeah, being 3 hours away seems to be a little detrimental to doing the job.
Yeah, I hate to sound callous because he does have a granddaughter that's in the hospital down there, but it seems like he's the one breastfeeding at this point.
Gotcha.
I tried to jump on earlier this morning, and Ken was there, and apparently he was trying to talk to me, and I couldn't hear him. And I wonder if it was because I installed Plumel, and I had that setting checked that is half duplex mode. So I unchecked it, and I don't know. I think it might be working.
Plumble is one of those things that some of the time when I use it, because I usually just install it when I need it. It's not constantly on my phone, so whenever I use it, I have to reset it up. I'm about 50% of the time amazed with it, and about 50% of the time think it's trash. So it's probably a setting thing.
Yeah, I think I got it. Unfortunately, I think this is where I'm allocated today, because my headphones seem to have crapped out on my computer, and that was really a pain in the ass a couple of years ago without headphones.
Yeah, for sure. You sound really good, though, so that's a plus.
Yeah, I got this old Samsung S4 donated to me a couple weeks ago, and it's doing pretty good. Except the guy that gave it to me kind of wishes he didn't, now that it's running Lineage 16, which is Android 9, and it was stuck on like 5 or something before.
That's crazy. I had one of those a few years ago, and it worked fine, but I wanted a newer phone, and so I gave that to my daughter, and my daughter used it for at least a couple years, and then it just died. And it wasn't a battery issue. It wasn't something that was easily fixable. But that thing lasted forever, and I actually really enjoyed it. But it's funny that it can still go up to the current stuff with Lineage.
Yeah, it's wonderful. But of course, now I've got everybody else going, oh, I've got my old S5, and I can't get them to give it to me, so I'm going to have to help them.
You're like, nah, I don't know how to do that. I'm sorry.
Here comes the boss. I think I might just leave this on for a bit and listen to what's happening, if there is anything. But geez, it gets so loud in there. As soon as these guys walk in, they just fire up that compressor and I can't hear a damn thing.
Well, hopefully some more people show up and we start having a conversation.
I'm pretty sure somebody will be here. Unfortunately, this is going to be our first year without the long ramblings of 50.
Yeah, that's going to be, it's going to be rough. Especially since he was pretty much here the whole time every year, but, you know, we'll make it through.
Oh yeah. Well, what came up under Dragon Blood, I mentioned the Buckminster Fuller's old quote of writing his friend a letter, getting a response back that he had been dead for a while. And he said, well, I beg to differ. I wouldn't have written him a letter if he wasn't perfectly alive. So that's kind of how I feel about this stuff. I lost a few people this past year too, which actually interrupted that play test that we'd lost to Bronx. I got an emergency call and I just thought they were screwing around, but that was word that I better get my ass to Florida to see Dad before he's gone.
Dang, that's hard. I guess you're excused in that circumstance.
Yeah, I'm just a little pissed at myself for not coming up with something along the lines of, oh wait, I did take that knife and they just arrested me or something stupid.
Or at least, like, if you knew you weren't coming back, just be like, I pull out the knife and get taken out in that way. At least there was some action.
Yeah. But, I don't know, I keep them with me. I never did meet 50 in person, but, geez, that guy's been part of my life now for well over 10 years. Okay, off to work. Have a good day. Hopefully I talk to you later.
Yeah, catch you later, man.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.